House Resources on a Saturday. I know this is the place where you'd rather be more than any other, especially that the trees are budding and the flowers are crawling out of the ground and the bird, the robins have arrived, and I don't know what else to add, but we'll do this. It's our last Saturday, and I certainly want to welcome all members in the audience who are here today and thank the committee members for being here. And the committee members currently present are Representative Edgman, Coring. We have a special guest, Representative Fairclough. We have Representative Seaton here, Representative Johnson, Representative Wilson, Representative Moses, and Representative Kawasaki.
Roses.
Moses.
Did I say it again?
I've been trying to part the waters ever since, and it hasn't worked yet, but I'm not going to quit trying.
I'm trying to get you off the committee. And Representative Guttenberg, and we now have a full complement with one guest. And today, according to the schedule, was public testimony. We have a number of people who want to testify. In some cases, we have them all in the same place, all representing the same group. And I think in all fairness, it wouldn't be unreasonable to ask people to limit their testimony when they're in part of a large group and the testimony is going to be the same. And I have no way to determine that ahead of time, nor am I attempting to say that I could. But if it happens, I might ask some people to say, and I think the same as the last guy type of thing. So with that, we'll move right into public testimony. And Mr. George Berry in Fairbanks, are you there?
Yes, I'm here this afternoon.
Mr. Berry, welcome to House Resources. You're the first person up for testimony. Can you identify yourself and any affiliation?
Good afternoon. My name is George Berry. Although I am a 30-year member of Teamsters Local 959, I'm here today to represent my own interests. And I do reside in the beautiful Goldstream Valley just north of Fairbanks, and it is a wonderful day here, and I hope that you folks are enjoying the same at your location.
That's my valley. That's where.
Representative Guttenberg wants to make a comment. That's where he's from.
Yes, I'm well aware of that, and we appreciate the excellent representation we get from you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Okay, Mr. Berry, go ahead.
Recently, I read in the Anchorage Daily News that the Governor Palin enjoyed an 83% approval rating from a recent poll. So she has been elected clearly by a mandate of the people and enjoys still that popularity with her form of government and the administration she's running. We've never had this level of support for any previous governor that I recall. The citizens put the Palin administration in office to bring new light and approaches to our state government. Her AGEA proposal is most welcome to me, for it clearly, definitively puts a gas line proposal on the table for a fair and open assessment by we the citizens and you our representatives. The citizens clearly spoke by a large margin to elect her as governor in the gas line approach that she wants to move forward. Recently, Mr. Hickel had an article in the Anchorage paper also in regards to our state's rights with regards to the oil and gas leaseholders. We have leverage, and I guess that's my main point today, is that you, our representatives, need, in my opinion, to use our leverage at its highest level. The leverage in the law for these leases asks the producers to produce, or we have leverage to deal with that situation. In my opinion, for 30 years, we've been waiting for them to produce. They haven't produced any gas from the North Slope. The AGEA legislation is the best vehicle to get the gas players to the table. I recall in recent testimony from, I believe, a company representative of BG Gas, a big international worldwide gas transmission producer, that their testimony was that a third-party owners of a gas transmission line is more common than producer ownership. The third-party pipeline owner is more interested in production and throughput, whereas producers don't necessarily hold those same ideals. In regards to changes and amendments to this legislation, a project labor agreement is a very positive amendment to put in this legislation. It will ensure real local hire of Alaskan residents.
Okay, Mr. Berry, I believe a PLA is already in there, and I'm going to ask you to limit your testimony to 3 minutes if you can, so we can cover as many people as possible. And right now, you're probably at the 3 minutes. Can you summarize?
Yes, sir. I support the Palin administration's AGIER proposal and ask that you move it forward this session. Thank you again for this opportunity to testify as a citizen.
And thank you very much, Mr. Berry. Appreciate having you you call in on this. Next, we have Mike Littlefield. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Mike, are you with Mr. Berry at the Teamsters Hall or something like that?
Yes, actually, I'm a business agent there with the Teamsters Local 959.
Excellent. Welcome to Resources. I'm looking forward. Go ahead and give us your testimony. And for the record, we have a secretary here, and for everyone else, we need to know a name and if there's a strange spelling, which yours doesn't have, to help the secretary get the recording correctly and certainly the affiliation. And you're already told us what yours is, but I need you to repeat it one more time to help the secretary.
Okay. My name's Mike Littlefield. I'm a business agent here in Fairbanks with the Teamsters Local 959. As you're probably aware of the Teamsters Low, we represent approximately 5,000 active and or retired members throughout the state of Alaska. Many of our members worked untold hours some years ago to construct this oil pipeline. We still have many members working on the slope or in slope-related jobs within the oil industry. Well, for approximately the last 30 years or so, we've all discussed construction of a gas pipeline here in Alaska. Many of our members are going from, or were planning on going from their oil construction jobs to gas-related jobs. However, to date, many of those members have given up on that idea. The previous administration negotiated a deal with the oil producers, which was brought to the legislative body last year, and as you are all aware, that effort did fail. Before you this afternoon is House Bill 177, and that's the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA, presented by Governor Palin and her new administration. Teamsters Local 959 would like to go on the record thanking Governor Palin and her team for the hard work put in thus far on AGIA, which we believe may be the necessary framework for construction of a gas pipeline here in Alaska. Some say AGIA is a huge risk and it destroys the opportunity for Alaskan gas line. Some say the bill favors the pipeline builders rather than the gas owners. Some even say the state should not tell bidders what to bid. Those of us representing workers here in Alaska believe that AGIA may well be the vehicle needed to move the gas pipeline project closer to a reality. In our view, AGIA is a tool for Governor Palin to use while doing her job in leading our state, just as all of our members need different tools to perform their jobs on a day-to-day basis. The governor and her staff have presented a very aggressive schedule that contains quantifiable results. The previous committee and the governor should be applauded for including a commitment to negotiate a project labor agreement to House Bill 177 as well. We do not believe that any pipeline company would disagree with a project labor agreement and that it would be justifiable on a project of this magnitude. With a PLA in place, we will be able to define the training needs of the workers, legally require local hire through hiring halls. We'd be able to define wages, hours, and working conditions to assure stability during the construction of this project. We thank Governor Palin again and her staff for their efforts in this area. Additionally, we request the committee include a definition of project labor agreement that would support the language included in the CS for Senate Bill 104 in the Judiciary Committee. And please, as you continue to work on this AGIA legislation, remember that the gas pipeline is vital to the future economic growth of this state. We have a window of opportunity here that we need to move forward. Such an opportunity will not last forever. Give Governor Palin the tools she needs to perform her job on behalf of all Alaskans and support the passage of House Bill 177. And thank you again for the opportunity to come and address this committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Littlefield. As the business agent, I'm sure you're well aware of the amount of effort that's put into it so far. And as you know, we expect this to reach finance this week. And expect to, at least the goal, have it passed out by the end of session. Project labor agreements are part of it, and in fact, I think it's been modified slightly and maybe substantially, depending on who's reading it, to make it much more clear. Any questions from the members? No questions. Thank you so much, Middle Littlefield. We're going to go now to Peter Captain.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Captain Sr. I am just newly elected to the vice presidency of the Canada Chiefs Conference. And just recently we passed a resolution supporting an AGEA project labor agreement, and I'd like to read the resolution. Whereas Canada Chiefs Conference represents 42 sovereign Alaska Native tribes and tribal organizations whose tribal lands include the majority of the right-of-way for the proposed Southern Route gas line projects being represented, considered, and whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference represents a large potential workforce of underutilized tribal members, both male and female, skilled and non-skilled, and whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference has a sincere desire to build the capacity and skill levels of that workforce to help address village infrastructure, construction projects, and bring increasing economic opportunity to its tribal members, both now and in the future. And whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference and some of its sub-regions and tribes have negotiated project, tribal, and other collective bargaining agreements with some of the construction unions, mainly with the labor's union and the operating engineers, and very positive outcomes. And whereas as a result of such agreements, Tanana Chiefs Conference has seen a marked increase and participation by its tribal members with regards to job opportunities, training programs, and apprentice programs, along with pension plan participation, medical plan participation, above and beyond Indian health service coverage. And whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference fully supports Alaska Native hire and Alaska local hire on whatever gas line project is finally decided upon. And whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference supports gas line construction project agreements that will deliver enforceable Alaska Native and local hire, along with skills training, pension plans, and medical plans. And whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference does not want to repeat what happened during the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System project regarding Alaska Native preference opportunities, and so Tanana Chiefs wants to be a part of a comprehensive project labor agreement at the project's inception. And whereas Governor Sarah Palin's Alaska Gas Line Investment Act calls for a negotiated project labor agreement for whatever gas line project is finally decided upon, and whereas Tanana Chiefs Conference has recognized that in light of applicable case law, a project labor agreement is the best vehicle to define real Alaska residency and real Alaska Native status to ensure preference and participation for its tribal members on any proposed gas line project. Now, therefore, be it resolved that Tanana Chiefs Conference supports Governor Sarah Palin's AGEA plan amendments as long as there is a project labor agreement that contains as one of its tenants enforceable project participation preference for qualified Alaska Native peoples in numbers and percentages that generally reflect the population demographics of the state of Alaska at the time the project begins. And I just want to thank you for allowing us to testify this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Captain, and congratulations on being vice president of the Tanana Chiefs. In the AGEA bill, as you mentioned, Governor Palin did mention explicitly Alaska hire provisions. I'm going to make a suggestion to you while I have you, I guess not in front of me, but in a conversation, that there's a lot of jobs that will be available after the pipeline is constructed and delivering gas. Those will be good quality, high-paying jobs that deal with all of the facets of management and maintenance and so many things. And I'm asking you to make sure, to the best of your ability, that we're also training people, not just construction, which will be fleeting, but for long-term jobs. I think this is the future of Alaska as well as the pipeline. We want to get local people who are running the operation. We have a very expensive gas treatment plant that will require workers. We have people operating compressors that will require workers. We have people in management, people in maintenance, people everywhere. And the goal is to get not have those jobs filled by someone else, if indeed we can fill them with Alaskans. And so I'm tasking you with the opportunity and the obligation both to see to it the most best we can that that's exactly the result we obtain. And I thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to go next to Mr. John Corbett. And Mr. Corbett, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is John Corbett. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been here for 6 years. I'd like to start by saying I support Governor Palin's IG amendment for a project labor agreement. It'll mean my friends and neighbors going to work. It'll ensure local people get to work first and will be the last to be laid off. It'll also mean that I will get a chance to put the wages I earn back into Alaska. I want to be able to build a house in Alaska and raise my family. I make a living as an Alaskan construction worker. The PLA means I go to work before people from the lower 48. And I appreciate being here to testify for that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Corbett. I appreciate that. And you were laborers 942. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 additional, 8, 9 additional people from laborers 942. And I'm going to ask, and they're all entitled to speak, and I respect that. I just want to be sure that we can repeat the same thing over and over again, or we could do the best we can to add new information, which is helpful to the committee. And so when we go on to Samantha Fanati, also with 942, I want to welcome her and ask her to the best of her ability to give all the new information that's possible and repeat some of the old for emphasis. If she feels that's important. So, Ms. Fanati, are you there? And did I get the pronunciation correctly?
Yes, that was correct.
Thank you. Name and affiliation, and for the record.
I'm Samantha Fonoti, and I live in Fairbanks as well. And I'm a laborer. And I agree with what John had to say. So...
Well,
thanks.
Thank you very much. What do you do as a laborer?
Everything that a laborer does.
Okay, what did you do the last time you had an 8-hour shift?
I worked on up north for Norcon. We do scaffold building and insulation.
Well, I got to tell you, it sounds like certainly one of the more important jobs because of the hazards involved with all of that. And I do appreciate you being part of the workforce.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
My last job out of the laborers was working for Norcon. So if you want to know what they do on that contract, I'd be delighted to have that conversation with you.
And that was Representative Guttenberg, and he is one of your what do we call it, co-workers or past workers?
Sister,
or
brother.
Brother workers. I'm sorry. So thank you. Next, we're going to go to Eric Fontern. I'm going to have to get this wrong. Fontenrot. Can you help me out there?
It's Fontenot. Fontenot.
Tenit. That helps a lot.
Tenot.
Ot. I'm sorry. I got that right. Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. Hey, my name is Eric Fontenot. I've been living in Alaska for about the past 7 years. And I came up initially with the United States Army, served about a 4-year tour over at Fort Wainwright, and, I've just been living in Fairbanks. I live off of Farmer's Loop right across from the golf course out that way. But and actually, my last hitch, I've been working up north and for the Laborers Local 942, and the last hitch up north I actually did with Norcon, and I've been working with Norcon since October. And the whole time I've been working with them, all we really hear about up there is, people talking about the gas pipeline coming in. And, I talked to some of my coworkers there, and, I hear this thing's been going on for, the past almost 30 years now. They've been talking about trying to put in the gas pipeline. And, it just seems to me like this is something that really needs to get done. I haven't been real politically active in the city as of yet, but I'm starting to get more that way now since I've joined up with the union. But either way, it just seems to me that this is something that really needs to be done, not only just to give jobs to, all our people in the hall, but, for the sheer fact that, we could actually be using this gas. We could have, reduced a strain on the economy as far as, with fuel. And everything else, I think it would help. But also more than that, you know, another thing that I see or have seen when I've been working up there is that, you know, there are a lot of people that they bring in from the lower 48, and that could be jobs for all of us, you know, jobs that we could be doing, but instead they're hiring from, you know, from other halls out of state to come work in Alaska. And just like they said, people that have never spent a day in Alaska, doesn't even know what it means to be in Alaska, and doesn't even, doesn't even know where our state capital is, or up north working on doing our jobs, you know, jobs that, you know, pay to put food in my kid's mouth. And, you know, I got a 9-month-old daughter, you know, that I'm raising out here. And, that's food in her mouth. That's a job I could be doing with my brothers out there. And, you know, that it's not getting done that way because they're important people from lower 48. But I do appreciate you letting me speak and give my testimony, and I think that's going to be it for me. Thank you.
And you're more than welcome, and I want to appreciate and tell you that we also thank you for your service in the U.S. Army. And when you talk to your buddies up north who say it's been 10 years, I'm going to give you just a short snippet of information at how you can respond correctly, and that is that the gas has been used and used and used constantly to re-inject into the ground so we can push oil out. And we finally reached the point where we've pushed a lot of oil out and we can let go of some of the gas now. But it has been useful. The companies have done a good job on making sure that a 20-year life from Prudhoe Bay is a 30-year life. And that is because we've been able to technologically do some things that we didn't even know we could have done when we began. And so for now, we're at that point where that gas has made I don't know how many round trips pushing oil all the time, and now we're ready to ship it. My guess is, my hope is, that 5 years from today, the gas will be in the line. That's a hope and a dream and a wish and all those things. And thank you for your service, and appreciate your testimony.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Taylor?
Yeah, I'm here.
Now, go ahead and identify yourself and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Okay. My name is Dirk Taylor. I've been living in Fairbanks, Alaska for the past 14 years. I'm working out of the Laborers 942 Union. And I'm just keep this really short. I just wanted to say that I really support this. It means a lot of jobs for people like us, people living here, people that are going to put this money back into our economy. And I think that people who are up here will take a certain pride in this job that people from the lower 48 won't necessarily take. I'm not taking anything away from them. I'm just saying that people who live up here and who are members of these unions up here, they want to go to work on this, and they want to have a sense of pride by saying, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, yeah, I was part of that. I did that. I think that simply because of that, everybody up here is going to be doing a lot better job, and it's a better way to go. And I just want to say thank you for your time, and that's all.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Taylor. We all appreciate that. I'm going to go next to Jacob Powdershell, and tell me if I got that one wrong.
Thank you. My name is Jake Powdershell. I've been living in Alaska for 24 years, and I just want to agree with what Dirk had to say. So I agree with the amendment to the IGEA bill. And it'll be a long-term economic solution, putting trade workers to work, not just in the construction, but in the maintenance and the operation. And that's about it. And I'm with Laborers Local 942.
Okay, Jacob, I certainly appreciate your testimony. I'm going to go next to Emily Spencer. And Emily, I have your first name spelled with an A-L-Y. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the recording secretary and your affiliation?
Yes, my name is Emily Spencer, and I am with the Local 942. I'm an apprentice laborer just on the verge of journeying out, and I've been in this for about 2 years, and I've been in Alaska for roughly around 14 years, and I support Governor Palin in this because it provides jobs for me to support my two children that I have. And we'll provide work for them also later on down the line if we can keep these jobs in Alaska for the people who live here. And that's about all I have to say on that.
Well, thank
you for your time.
Oh, and thank you for your time. I appreciate that. And I guess it's probably pretty clear that we're talking to a lot of members from 942 who all appreciate the GIA plan and the and work that Governor Palin has done so far. I'll try to remember to pass that on to her when next time we meet. So I'm going to go next to Robert Purcell.
I'm here.
Would you go ahead and identify yourself and your affiliation for the secretary?
Yes, my name is Robert Purcell. I'm here with Laborers 942. I'm a local resident of Fairbanks. I've been here since I was born, 27 years ago. My family has been here in Fairbanks since the early 60s. And they put a lot of work into to building our community, making it a better place. And I feel that through the PLA and the AGEA proposal, we'd be able to do a lot more work for our people, a lot more community building through jobs and through the ability for us to be able to create more jobs for not only ourselves and the people that we live here with, but for our children and our future. It means a lot to me to be able to say that I'm an apprentice in the laborers program and that they're going to give me the training that I'm going to need not only to help with a pipeline, but also to work in future jobs that come afterward. I think it's important for us to be able to provide not only for our children, but to be able to say that, you know, I've got a pension plan and that I'm going to be able to survive after, you know, I have to retire. And that's one of the reasons why I'm really here in support of the PLA and the AGEA proposal. And I think that's about all I've got to say on the matter.
Well, I appreciate that. That's helpful. Next, I'll go to Brian Lint. Brian, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Brian, identify yourself and affiliation.
My name is Brian Lint. Here testifying for the PLA, and I'm with the Laborers Union, Local 942 as well. Just another laborer wanting to get out that this whole pipeline thing needs to go through. It'd be nice to see. I'm as well as another citizen that has heard about this for a long time. As you said, it has been going on, and it would be nice to see in the apprenticeship program as well. All the training that I've got so far and that I'm currently taking is helping me. I've learned a lot and still learning, and I'd like to put it to work, and we'll see how that goes. And I just want to thank you for being able to testify for this.
Okay, and Brian, I'm going to make a comment. I never think of you as just another laborer.
Yeah.
I think the laborers are the ones that turn the wrenches and operate the handles on the loaders and drive the trucks, and they're the ones that do the work. So my impression of you and all the workers are you're the people that actually built this place, and I want to thank you for that.
I appreciate it.
Jerry Walker from Jerry Walker, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Mr. Walker, go ahead and identify yourself. And it says here, self, if you have an affiliation with a union or with any kind of organization that somehow is affiliated with pipeline construction, I'll need to know that.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Jerry Walker, and I respectfully address you today as an individual who is proud to have lived and worked in the great state of Alaska for 18 years. I am appreciative of the administration's efforts and your careful considerations to be responsible stewards of our resources. I remind you today of one very important theme, and from that, ask four questions for your careful consideration as you continue this critical process. The theme is the free enterprise system and state government's role within. Question one, is the purpose of AGEA enhance your role as legislators to induce private enterprise by providing $500 million in their risk-reward analysis, or should it merely be to ensure an open-for-business environment that is characterized by minimal interference? Please consider being less prescriptive and more general in your objectives for your bid requirements. Question two, who best can evaluate risk and potential reward, private enterprise or state government? If as legislators you want to evaluate risk, I suggest you focus on how we as a state deal with the probable negative growth without individuals and companies willing to invest required capital. Please consider being less prescriptive and more general in your objectives for bid requirements. Question three, is the real question of fiscal stability more important for potential shippers of our natural resources that we as a state have sold and hope to sell more of, or should it be for both current and future generations of Alaska to determine how we can pay for expected services? Please consider fixing severance tax rates that will promote investment in Alaska. Question four, do we really think we can expect current and future owners of our natural resources to compete in a global marketplace when, under the proposed bill, two commissioners will be responsible to pick a winner? Please consider allowing for more proposals that will encourage more competition in our project, such that the ultimate winner will be better prepared to compete globally and hence provide more fiscal stability to Alaskans for many years to come. I respect your commitment to Alaskans, present and future. I thank you for your careful consideration and request your responsible action and ultimate decision to this bill in this legislative session that is, as you well know, soon to expire.
Thanks, Mr. Walker. It's our wish also that we pass this out this legislative session. And I thank you for your testimony. Next, I'm going to go to Jay Quackenbush. Jay, also your name and affiliation.
Yeah, Jay Quackenbush. I'm president of the Fairbanks Building and Construction Trades Council. And as I've sat here and listened to these members of the Laborers Local, I reflect back on my time as an electrician out in the field working alongside laborers and operators and pipe fitters, and I've had great opportunity, and some of that was on the North Slope. I know as a representative of the IBEW, the Electrical Union, and as president of the Building Trades, labor organizations here in Alaska are poised to train and employ Alaskans. And those are Alaskans that are currently members of ours and members that are not to this day. We feel a PLA would give us the opportunity to further our investment in this state and help the employment application of this job, which in itself gives a pipeline licensee and the state of Alaska a surety in a pipeline built on time and under budget and get the gas moving as fast as we can for all of our use. So Representative Gatto and the rest of the committee, I thank you very much for the time.
Quackenbush, I'm going to ask you a question. Since you're the president, a PLA, I think we all understand and know what it means. Just for clarification, though, it does not restrict the laborers to be union members. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir. They do not have to become a member. They would be working under the terms, conditions of a bargaining agreement, just like every other laborer on that project.
So they could be possibly non-union members, but they would be working for the same wages as if they were union members.
That's correct, sir.
And would they have any requirement to pay union dues or a representation fee or anything like that?
Yes, they would, sir. As you know, having thousands of workers on a job site, the labor representatives throughout the unions would require a lot of time and effort working with the companies to manage that workforce, and that's what those dues would go towards is their representation under that collective bargaining agreement.
I appreciate that. Mr. Quackenbush, was that your cell phone that went off?
I'm afraid so, sir. Does that mean I'm buying?
We have some very specific rules here about that, and I believe they transfer into a dozen jelly-filled, various chocolate-covered things. And so the next time we meet, I'm kind of hopeful that
Hey, you'll be paying your debt. I do appreciate your
paying his dues.
You've kind of lightened the area around here. I appreciate your phone going off. I hope that was your wife and want to know what the heck you were doing.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, next we'll go to Daniel Furman. Daniel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You have a cell phone?
I do, but I lost it on the way here, actually.
Could be a lucky event. Daniel, go ahead and give us your name and affiliation.
I'm Daniel Furman. I'm with the Laborers Union 942, and I was born in Fairbanks, Alaska, and raised here, and hope to retire here. And I just came out to agree with my brothers and sisters on the Palin's AGIA amendment, and that's about it for me.
Sounds good, Daniel. Appreciate your testimony. Now we're going to go to Gerald K.W. Brown. Gerald, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for having this public testimony. Thank you for your graciousness. And I have had the very good fortune of meeting you, or most of you, on the committee a couple of weeks ago, and I really applaud the work and effort that you folks put into these meetings and the efforts that you, as you mull over all the different options and the testimony that you have to go through. I'm not going to belabor what has gone before, although I do agree that a PLA is a very important part of the whole process. I just wanted to reflect a little bit on some of the testimony that has come before you as kind of an objective or out-of-the-box observation that I've seen during some of the testimony. I sent all the members on the committee an email from myself. I don't know if you actually recognized it or not. But I did send some observation points, especially after Mr. Macy made his testimony before your committee. I was quite taken aback by his position. I don't know how you as a committee dealt with that, but I was very taken aback by that. It seems like the big three that actually have control of the gas right now don't really want to participate in this process at all and are dragging their feet even longer and longer. And I hope that with you and somehow I was listening to Kathy Forrester's testimony on the use of the gas, as you had alluded to, recycling of the gas as it goes through, that you can come to some kind of a fairness in how you start to distribute or start to tap into the source of gas that we have on the North Slope. And I don't know if that's going to be part of a GIA or if it will have to be a separate bill, but I think as the legislative process, it seems that you will have to start to look at that and may have to mandate some release of the gas on a annual or some type of process along those lines. I was very impressed with Mr. Keenan's presentation from BG. I was impressed by his third-party observation from the outside, even though he has some interest in gas there. I was interested to see how he saw the big picture, and I hope that you as a committee also saw the need for the gas and the production of the gas and the demand that will be coming from this, and will push this project through. I hope that AGIA does give a fair, balanced approach to distributing gas from Alaska. I do urge that you pass this this measure. I applaud your work on this, hopefully we'll see a gas line in the next few years.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mr. Brown. Just for clarification, AGIA is a bill that simply allows us to find someone that we'll call a licensee, who will then be the person that will have the most to do, or the organization with the most to do with moving the gas to market. Our work here is done when we finish up with AGIA and present a structure for the administration, the Palin administration, to select the licensee.
and we have some very smart people. And while we're at it, I just wanted to say I've heard the term, because I've reached the end of the sheet of people that are from Fairbanks, although there may be more. And I heard one reference to brothers and sisters, and it kind of hit a little note with me, because as a firefighter, we always refer to each other as brothers and sisters, and because we always work together. And that tells a lot about the quality of the force that's out there, the labor force. And I just wanted to comment that that this building is full of legislators who think of themselves very much the same way. So we're on the same kind of team. And with that, I want to appreciate all those people from Fairbanks who testified. And now,
Representative Gatto, one more thing.
I'll give you a moment, because there are several more sheets of people that want to testify, and we want to make sure we get through this.
Can I say one more?
Yeah, go ahead.
One more thing. I noticed that we also made the observation that there are many people that are working on the slope or in the industry within the state that have jobs, but they live outside the state of Alaska. I would also entertain the notion that perhaps a state income tax might be in order to help to encourage people to be residents within the state, because then you can tailor the tax refund to the fact that if you're living in the state, you get a better tax return than if you live outside the state and you're taking that income out of it, and that way you were able to keep and hold some of that income here in the state of Alaska. But I would encourage you to look at that as a possibility to add multiple stream revenues to the state coffers, as well as also rewarding residents of Alaska by charging an income tax.
Okay, Mr. Brown, I think we got it, and we've really discussed this at great length in the past and continue the discussion. We're on it, trust me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to shift now to Valdez. Mr. Melberg, Jerry Melberg, are you there?
Yes, I am, and good afternoon, and thanks for allowing me to speak. I'm Jerry Melberg from Valdez. I'm a 26-year resident of Alaska. I retired after 20 years working in the oil industry on the Alaska pipeline, mechanical administrator, and currently I'm a licensed journeyman plumber. First, I'd like to say I really support some type of inducement to get the gas pipeline built and in operation. But I have developed a long-range concept that I think makes a lot better use of the $500 million incentive. I believe this incentive for construction and operation of the gas line, but also I believe this plan would accomplish the following. It would totally dovetail in with Governor Palin's commitment to reduce greenhouse gases. I believe it would get the four rail belt and most all other electrical utilities on a common state strategy. It probably would eliminate the need for any coal fire plants, such as they're talking to build at Matanuska area. It would reduce most everyone's electrical costs, and it would help the producers to help maintain oil production, and it would provide them a good economic and environmental incentive, and also for the state. This plan's kind of comprehensive, so I don't really think this teleconference is the time or the place. So the reason I'm speaking is I want to know who I would talk to in the state and in what format to show them this plan.
Representative Hawker, Ways and Means, Chair.
Or John Harris.
Yeah, the response we get from the committee is we have an organization called House Ways and Means, and it has a chairman, and they deal with ways to enhance revenues for the state, and the chairman of that is Representative Mike Hawker. And it should be easy for you to locate him on the state website, and I certainly appreciate your testimony. I'm going to switch now to Anchorage, list of people from Anchorage. Jerry McCutcheon, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jerry McCutcheon, and I'm not affiliated with anybody here or elsewhere on the line. Mr. Roses, after you get through parting the waters, you might want to help Chairman Gatto apologize to those who he has led to believe that there was going to be a gas line. The legislature and the Governor Palin have not been honest with the public. They have led the public to believe there's going to be a gas line, when in fact there will not be a gas line. Ann's press release that she was not going to lobby the legislature on our gas line legislation outside of her staff repeatedly cherry-picking misleading information to give to the legislature and the public. I doubt if her lobbying the legislature would do much good. They have already served notice that they are going to take their time and do it their way. I think Palin has finally come to the conclusion she cannot obtain any semblance of an open season, thus no hope of a gas line. The outlook for Palin's gas line is nil to non-existent. The most damaging presentation occurred when the exasperated Senator French, chairman of Senate Judiciary, said and asked of Kathy Foster of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, after he could not get her to give him any amount of gas or any time the gas would be available. Kathy said, French said, well, we still have the 2.7 BCFD. Kathy replied, somebody would have to apply to the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission for that 2 BCFD offtake or some portion of it. And the AOGC would have to rehear the Rule 9, the 2.7 BCFD, and after the hearing, there would be no gas available. Thus, the once-available gas for at least the last 20 years, Rule 9 gas offtake of 2.7 BCFD, is now non-existent. It exists on paper only, and if you try to apply for it, it isn't going to be there. There is no gas available for a gas line, or is there any indication of when there will be gas available for a gas line, if ever, and I'll bet on the latter. Having predicted the disappearance of the 2.7 BCFD ever since it was first allowed, I will predict that the 2.7 BCFD will disappear again in 10 years, in 20 years. The illusion of a gas offtake for a gas line will always be like chasing a rainbow. It will always be just ahead and never there when one gets to where they thought it was. The gas offtake is like a mirage, just over the hill, but never there. Every time it comes to take the gas, the reservoir will have to be evaluated as if it were a new discovery, and a new discovery with all the infrastructure in place. And we will always be faced the need for the gas for oil production. Palin was cognizant of the need for the rehearing of the 2.7 BCFD gas offtake. She was chairman of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. She must have known what the outcome of a rehearing would be. Palin just tried to scam her way through in hopes
Mr. McCutcheon,
the legislature would not find out when the...
Mr. McCutcheon, I'm going to have to limit you to about a few more seconds,
Mr.
and then I'm going to have to cut you off.
I think I have a right to be heard.
You are being heard.
I think the court's going to hold that I have a right to be heard, not only by the legislature, but also the public.
Yeah, I need you to summarize. Everyone who speaks has a certain amount of time because there are so many that want to speak. So I'm going to ask you, can you summarize in less than a minute or not?
Mr. Chairman, if this bill ever ends up in court, I'll be there, and I'll give you a chance to testify on the stand why you would not allow the public hearing. It's my opinion that the court not only to be heard, but also to be heard by the public. And there's a big difference in rather you people taking the testimony and burying it somewhere.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. McCutcheon. We're going to go next to Paul Liard. Paul, are you there?
I am here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 177. My name is Paul Laird, L-A-I-R-D, and I'm general manager and testifying on behalf of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. Our 400-plus member companies provide the goods and services that make Alaska's oil, gas, and mining industries possible and provide more than 30,000 Alaskan jobs. first and foremost, the Alliance wants a gas project sooner rather than later, and with the greatest long-term benefits for the state of Alaska, Alaskan workers, Alaskan businesses, and all Alaskans. We believe this act will fail in its objective of achieving a gas project unless key changes are made prior to passage. First, bid requirements set out in the bill are too prescriptive and should be replaced with broad objectives. Bid requirements will limit competition in the application process. The prescriptive nature of the bill guarantees that creative and mutually beneficial approaches that address the state's needs will never be explored, and it likely will preclude some prospective applicants from participating. Second, the bill places too much emphasis on mitigating the short-term financial risks incurred by the pipeline builder and too little on addressing the much longer-term and greater risks of gas shippers. It offers shippers a non-binding, trust-me commitment for fiscal stability lasting a fraction of the project life and does nothing to fix severance tax rates that the administration admits won't work. Third, the $500 million incentive is unnecessary. It has the potential to turn pretenders into contenders for a state license, and we're skeptical about placing Alaska's future into the hands of any entity that requires a $500 million contribution in order to pursue a $30 billion project. Applicants that need to be bought with the $500 million may not be worth acquiring. We're also concerned about provisions mandating the use of rolled-in tariff rates for pipeline expansions, establishing a virtual monopoly for the state's licensee at the possible expense of other qualified projects, and allowing a pair of commissioners too much leeway in how they select a licensee. The Alaska Gasline Inducement Act may be our last and best chance to make a North Slope gas project a reality, but only if it's fixed before it's passed. In order to succeed, the bill must reflect the interests of Alaskans, of the developer and transporter, and of North Slope producers and shippers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laird. Do you have a question? Thank you. Now, Paul Kendall in Anchorage, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
You bet. Well, you know, I'd like to start off beginning with thanking you folks. I've watched each of the chairmen of the various committees, and I've watched the various members. And I am certainly proud of all of you that, as an Alaskan, the way you've handled this, and I thank you for that. Continuing on here, won't be too long. First, I sent you about 10 pages of various aspects of hydrogen use in Alaska and some other little anecdotal things on some coal gasification, et cetera. I hope you'll find that entertaining reading. Now, to begin my presentation, nearly all things send signals, signs, or indications of things that have been or things to come in some form or another. You folks, because the producers have sent you confusing, admonishing, conflicting, minimal, and uncertain signals, must prepare for a worst-case scenario in direct proportions to the signals you have received from the producers. This makes it all the more important that you stay focused, in the queue, in the interview, learn me up, hearing, testimony, and above all, the United as Alaskans mode we stand. I strongly, therefore, believe that you should gather and pass the initiative or whatever it takes to stay in session the rest of the year. You have to pay yourselves a decent salary for you and your families. There are many critical details to come and more need for insights into a few more critical sectors, as I will list below. I'm trying to find my locations here. To mention a few of those, the capacity needs to be discussed in totality. The take really needs to be a cautious and discussion. Social impacts, infrastructure, tailgating large projects such as Agrarium and ARR, the gas price charges to residential users at a true and actual cost, the Texas company purchase of NSTAR, the GTP, the coal gasification project process, hydrogen gas, several others are in need of an unhurried, methodical, and professional accounting for an awareness, testimonies, and hearings. And I'm just about to close up here. It is therefore, again, that I strongly urge the following in addition, that you contact the governors or their designees of Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, Seattle, Portland, and other leading cities located south and southwest of the Alberta hub. You should invite their emissaries to come to Alaska. The reason for this request for the southwest coastal states and Alaska, for the southwest coastal states to come to Alaska, is for a roundtable forum on energy needs of those states and Alaska's role. Because we as Alaskans feel compelled to reach out to our fellow Americans to see if they are in need of our resources before we should send them elsewhere. The reason you should do this also is, number one, it is the right thing to do. It is the honorable thing to do. It is the American thing to do. It is the Alaskan things to do. It is a smart business decision. It is a necessary component for a decision, especially if you get forced to a co-venturing position. How can you not do this? I'll skip that part. And finally, in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, I am having a great time learning so much about the gas piping shipping industry. I am anxious to see how the take is divided, as Mr. Massey put it. And I only regret one thing, and that is that no one is paying me to learn this thing, okay? Now, in closing, and this is the final closing, this is to the governor, the House, the Senate, and the unforeseen and the unseen or unheard others who work behind you in support of you. Should I forget, I am enjoying watching, when I can, you all work together for the benefit of us all. What a great job and legacy all of you are part of. This process you are involved in now is, in my opinion, how our society will need to be represented now and on into the future. Just as Alaska is now a new frontier for many, so it is that you all may represent the new frontier for how our society will need to be represented by the new public servants of the future. It has to be an open and full-time commitment process called a job. I thank you, and I thank you on the behalf of those other people who feel the same way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kendall. I'm not sure you're going to get a lot of support for a year-round session, but I appreciate your testimony. Avis Thompson, are you there in Anchorage?
Mr. Chairman.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Aves Thompson, that's A-V-E-S, the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing trucking interests from Barrow to Ketchikan for more than 49 years. Our more than 200 members represent all of the diverse trucking operations in the state and many associate members who provide goods and services to our industry. On behalf of the ATA, I thank you for the opportunity to testify on the subject of AGEA. The highest priority of the Alaska Trucking Association is to get a gas line built, up and running, and delivering Alaska's gas to market. We applaud the governor and her team for promptly presenting AGEA to the legislature for their consideration. We believe, like others, that AGEA has a chance to bring a gas line to fruition. We also believe that certain changes must be made to make the gas line a reality. I will address some of the important issues as we see them. Bid requirements of the bill are far too specific. The better approach may be to set performance specifications or expectations or outcomes and let the bidders address how they will meet those expected outcomes. There may be other ways to reach these mutually beneficial outcomes, and the prescriptive nature of the current bill guarantees we will never hear the alternatives. The bill needs clear and objective criteria for evaluating applications. Some recommendations for criteria are perhaps the best financial return to the state, the lowest level of risk of delays due to lawsuits, etc., the highest probability of success, jobs, in-state use of gas, etc., and expansion provisions for adding gas to the line. The bill places too much emphasis on mitigating the short-term financial risks incurred by the pipeline builder and too little to address the much longer-term and greater risks of gas shippers. Fiscal certainty is an important issue for those that will be asked to commit to the long-term firm transportation agreements worth billions of dollars over the life of the agreements. Some notion of future tax or royalty law or at least policy must be part of the deal. As a corollary to the previous point, we feel the $500 million giveaway is unnecessary and imprudent, as we would like to see
the successful licensee be financially capable of making their decisions based on the sound economics of the project rather than a subsidy or handout from the state. It seems that existing shippers should not be forced to subsidize new shippers by sharing the cost of pipeline capacity expansions. It would seem more equitable and predictable to provide that the new shippers pay the cost of expansion. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, these are a few of our concerns, and I'm sure that you will hear from others today as they share their testimony. The Alaska Trucking Association is eager for this project to succeed and stands ready to assist in any way to help make this dream a reality. Thank you for your time.
And thank you very much, Mr. Thompson. Maynard Tapp is next. Maynard, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me? Mr. Chairman?
We hear you just fine. Please proceed.
My name is Maynard Tapp. I'm a citizen of Alaska since 1990 and an Alaskan in spirit since 1954 when my dad came to work in Barrow, Alaska. My comment is to do the deal now. At today's spot price of $7.50 per million BTUs, the state share at 12.5% would be 94 cents per million BTUs. Every day we wait at 1 million BTUs per 1,000 cubic feet, every day we wait, we lose revenues of $4,224,000. I worked on the gas line study from January 2001 to March 2002, about 15 months. This study spent approximately $125 million to get near the end of the conceptual design. I have actually, in my testimony that I faxed down there, there is a chart there that maybe some of you folks could take a look at in terms of the life cycle of a project. We accomplished a lot during that time frame. Everyone worked hard and fast. The results of the effort indicated the producers wanted to move forward with the pipeline project. It will take a new player at least 15 months, say 450 days, to get to that point where the producers are today. At $4.2 million per day, that's $1.9 billion lost in state revenues just to get to where we already are, close to the end of the conceptual design. At the same time, Prudhoe Bay production is declining 6% per year. Therefore, related state revenues from the oil production is declining at the same rate. And and at that same time, competing projects and technologies are moving forward. The chart I have included in my testimony is one that I've obtained working with a world-class engineering company. It was used to help them determine the amount of contingency used in any point during the life cycle of a project. It is therefore a measure of confidence that a project has regarding known and unknown costs. Contingency, just for definition purposes, contingency is not a number you stick on top of something to make it work. It's actual costs that have not yet been recognized. The milestones cannot be compressed. You already have 2 or 3 years of testimony that you've all experienced. Will you learn anything in the next 15 months that $1.9 billion in lost revenues will justify? Please be leaders. Do the deal now. Thank you.
Mr. Tapp, I'm going to ask you the question. The term do the deal now, I'm not sure. I mean, that's what we're doing, isn't it?
Well, under the circumstances of we've kind of stopped, and it sounds like we're starting over again. We've already got 2 years of experience and testimony that most of the legislature has been exposed to. And I think although the commissioner and the administration has said, it is my own personal opinion, you could pick up and negotiate based on the comments that were given during the last governor's proposal. There's enough information there to pull together a deal, modify it, and sign it, and get this thing underway. We could be within a year or two. We could be under rather than 36 months. We could be looking towards an open season. So I think it's important, really. I support the governor's openness and transparency in their in the AGEA. I'm afraid if we try to give a licensee $500 million to do what, I'm not exactly sure that we're going to be losing 15 months. That's my concern.
Okay, I appreciate that, Mr. Tapp. I need to go next to Eric Dompeling.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon to you. And your affiliation, please?
I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the Resource Committee for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 177, the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act. My name is Eric Dompling, and I'm Vice President of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. When I came to Alaska 37 years ago, there was a term that doesn't get used as much today. That term is, we don't care how they do it outside. But over the course of those 37 years that I've been here, things have changed a bit in Alaska. We now provide roughly 20% of oil consumed in the United States, and the revenue that comes from that oil development supports the state economy, as you all know. But it was not the state that risked the capital to explore and develop those leases. AGEA is intended to expand resource sales, this time the gas associated with North Slope Oil. Gas has been produced at Prudhoe, as you know, for the last 30 years, and I thank you for making the point about the recycling of gas through the Prudhoe Bay field. In that time, that gas has been shown to provide an additional 3 billion barrels of oil. And today, that gas, that 8 billion cubic feet of gas being produced with the oil and reinjected every day, is creating a handling issue and needs to be shipped to market. This gas project will be world class by any definition, but we're not alone in the development of world-class resources. There's a project already underway in Qatar that has 1,500 trillion cubic feet of known reserves, 42 times larger than all the 35 trillion cubic feet of gas currently producible on the North Slope. The pipelines for that project are in place, the tankers are built, and the expansion is moving forward. Heard for years from oil producers that any project must compete globally for capital investment and be judged on the return on the capital invested. Based on that factor alone, construction and expansion of any project will not be prescribed, but determined by the economics. North Slope Gas Project will ultimately not be a political decision. It will be an economic decision by a resource leaseholder, whether they have known reserves or are exploring, hoping to develop future reserves. In a free market, the tariffs will determine if a line gets built or expanded. In order to promote a project, the state's role should be to ensure that the resource owners know what the terms and conditions will be. And I urge you not to leave the tax issue open to interpretation. Open-ended contracts expose both sides to litigation, not construction. The efforts of Governor Palin and her team to advance the North Slope Gas Project through AGEA are applauded by all Alaskans, including members of the Alliance. However, the Inducement Act as currently drafted does not include clear objective criteria for evaluating the economics of a project, and without those economic objectives, this project will not move forward. Attempts by government entities to determine economic viability do not have an enviable track record. Let the market decide by asking for a quote-unquote best proposal or best offer proposal that is open and transparent and can be judged by the merits of the economics. Because in the end, it all comes down to the tariff. I spoke earlier about Alaskans not caring how things are done outside. Today, we compete in a global market. Let us not focus only on Alaska's wants, but focus on how we compete for the development of our resources in that global arena. The Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act may be the best opportunity to make a North Slope Gas Project a reality. If it is succeed, the bill must acknowledge the interests of not only Alaskans, but those of the project developer, the transporter, and the North Slope producers and shippers. Thank you for your time. This concludes my testimony.
And Mr. Dompling, congratulations on being vice president of the Alliance. They're the service company for all the other companies. Am I correct?
Actually, as you well know, it is a trade organization of 400 different members that represents roughly 30,000 employees in the state of Alaska, and we encourage responsible development of Alaska's natural resources.
And I appreciate that. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Ron McFeeters, are you there? Ron, can you hear me? Okay, we're not connecting with Ron. Meg Lum, are you there? We're having some problem with Anchorage connection, so I'm going to go back to Fairbanks. Kevin Knox. Kevin, can you hear me?
Hello. Yes, I can.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Would you give your name and affiliation for the record?
Yes, I will. My name is Kevin Knox. I'm out of the local 942 in Fairbanks. I've been an Alaskan for the past 12 years. And I support Governor Palin's AGIA amendment for the Project Laborers Agreement. Why? It will mean my friends, my neighbors going to work. It will ensure local people to get work first and will be the last to be laid off.
It also means that I will get a chance to put the wages I earn back into Alaska. I want to be able to build a house in Alaska and raise a family in Alaska. I make a living as an Alaskan construction worker, laborer, pipeliner. A PLA means I go to work before people from the lower 48. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knox. Is Tammy Wilson there?
Yes, I am.
Tammy, are you calling from someplace different than previous callers?
No, I'm calling from Fairbanks with everybody else.
Okay. Thank you very much. Would you go ahead and give us your affiliation as well as your name?
Sure, not a problem. My name is Tammy Wilson. I guess my affiliation would be I am a wife of a millwright and a mother of an apprentice in the operators union, so pretty affiliated with unions. I just want to thank you for putting in a PLA, and I want to thank you for also being there. I know you probably have heard more than we can imagine. I just want to tell you that I do have a son who has benefited from the Department of Labor grant to become a heavy diesel mechanic. He was a 20-year-old sitting on my couch not knowing what to do with himself, and this grant came along just at the right time, so he's one of the first to actually get out of this program. So he will actually go immediately into the operators union, where now he will make good wages, have health insurance, which he currently doesn't have, and a pension plan. It will also allow him to buy a house, raise his family, and be able to spend his money actually here in Alaska. So I just kind of want to let you know as a group that, you know, we are using these funds and we are training our young people, not just for the pipeline, but also into these careers that hopefully will come from it. And I just want to thank you for putting this PLA in and thank you for taking out your time on a Saturday.
Miss Wilson, don't go away.
Okay.
I have a question for you. You don't happen to have a daughter, do you?
Mostly one that works in your office.
Oh, no, the same one, huh?
Well, I actually have been told I'm not supposed to say that in public.
Well, I'll say this in public. She's just doing a bang-up job. I really appreciate her being there, and I'm going to triple her pay as of tomorrow.
Well, I just want to say as a mother, I am very thankful that she is under you because all I have heard is wonderful stories and experiences that she has been able to bring back.
Would you repeat that again, please? No.
You're wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Joseph Boyle.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Joseph, would you go ahead and give us your affiliation?
Sure. My name is Joseph Boyle. I'm a recent graduate of the Laborers Local 942 Apprentice Program, and I support Governor Palin's AGIA Amendment and the Project Labor Agreement. Basically means I can continue working, have a future for my family, build a house, also keep putting money away for that retirement. So that's about all I have to say.
And I appreciate that. And don't forget to put money away for your children, too.
Yeah, you got to do that.
Thanks. All right. Next, I'm going to try and back up a bit here, see if we can get back to Anchorage. Ron Fetters, are you there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we do now. We apparently got cut off earlier, but go ahead with your testimony as well as your name and your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron McFeeters. I'm the president of Labor's Local 341, a resident of Palmer, Alaska. Been a resident for 35 years. We represent 6,000 members statewide through the District Council of Laborers. I appreciate your work you guys are doing in the committee, and I just wanted to urge you, because of time constraints, to leave the PLA language in the bill as it presently is, and I thank you for your time.
And Mr. McFetter, since I also live in Palmer, have we run into each other?
You know, we've shook hands a couple times at the fair and other places.
Okay, make sure you identify yourself to me. Being the president of 341, I'm certainly want to have longer chats with you than just hi, enjoying the fair.
I sure will.
Thank you very much. Next, I'll go to Meg Lum. Meg, are you there?
I am.
You have a very famous last name in my books. Did you know Dr. Lum?
I do, and my father was president of the teachers union that we had up here. I taught in the valley for many years, as well did my mother.
All right. Go ahead with your testimony for us.
Well, thank you. My name is Meg Lum. I'm proud to be an apprentice with the Alaska Laborers Training School, Local 341. I also am from the valley. I'm a third-generation lifetime Alaskan. I'm a dedicated voter, and I'm also a single mother. Currently, I'm obtaining my trade skills during my apprenticeship program, and that's allowing me to provide for my daughter. I'm very excited about the upcoming gasoline project. I'm hoping it's going to be a source of employment for those reinvesting their income in the state. And I am convinced that the AGEA must include a project labor agreement. Just as we Alaskans are proud of our state, I think we should also be proud of our workers and the way our legislatures are representing our best interests. A project labor agreement is going to ensure Alaskan hire on the most important project that the state has seen. I think that we can keep the economy strong and keep apprentices like myself and our families in the state with the security of a decent wage and benefits. I look forward to working on the gas line to maintain my independence as a single mother and as a taxpayer. Please enforce the use of a project labor agreement in the AGEA, and thank you for your time allowing me to speak today.
And thank you very much, Meg, but I do have a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you, and I'm just wondering, I probably should have asked somebody earlier, but the one of the other committees made a change in the project labor agreement that requires the applicant, that's a pipeline applicant, to utilize the Department of Labor's job centers and internet hiring program to the extent practicable. Do you, is that using the in-state hiring processes, is that in any way detrimental to the project labor agreement from your aspect, or do you think that's a good change, or have you looked at that?
I haven't looked at it. I'm not familiar.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'm going to go to Tim Sharp. Tim, can you hear us?
Yes, Representative Gatta, thank you very much. I guess I'd like to begin by making a Saturday that much more difficult for Representatives Guttenberg and Kawasaki. It's 60 degrees here. The sun's out. We do hope to see them back here for cleanup day on the 5th. They're needed at home. and I guess if through the chair, I'd love to take a crack at Representative Seaton's question, because we've had personal experience with that. Not too long ago, when we had the Fort Knox gold mine built, and people were actually instructed from the lower 48 with a packet to report directly after they drove the highway and got up here in their rigs from outside, to go directly to the job service and sign up and explain that they'd been here for a month and they had intended to stay, which made them Alaskan residents, and they were referred up to the Fort Knox mine. So I guess that's where I see it's not going to threaten the PLA, but it will certainly threaten the results of what we're trying to accomplish, which is putting Alaskans to work first and making sure Alaskans are there last as the project comes down. And just if that helps any, and if Representative Seaton wanted to question me on that, I'd be happy to take it. But I guess what I'm here to do today is actually we represent. I'm the business manager of the Alaska District Council of Labor's, which includes Local 71, Local 942, and Local 341. Both Local 341, you just heard President McFeeters, and Local 942 have over 60 years of putting Alaskans to work and training Alaskans here, and very proud of that record. I'm here today basically to play team and help support our governor in getting our gas to market. We all have heard testimony today how this is it. This could be our defining moment, and what are we going to do, and how will we be remembered by history? We also support Alaskans building the pipeline, too, and as you're all aware, with the Zobel decision, the constitutional definition of Alaskan resident is 30 days with the intent to stay, which is exactly what Representative Seaton kind of caught on there. The project labor agreement is the only legal way we have to raise that bar and increase how we define Alaskan residency. For us, right now it's 1 year before we're even going to allow any people to sign up on the hiring hall list, and that's before the project has started. So that tends to increase the good outcomes in terms of Alaskans going to work. It also allows us, and I say us meaning the building trades, the construction trades, to get going on the training needs. It takes 3 to 5 years to turn journeymen out. That's about the window we're looking at now, and to wait any longer will cause us to miss that opportunity. And Representative Gatto mentioned the legacy jobs, and I appreciate that, because that's a key sticking point in my craw as a Fairbanks, and that hears the jet engines on a daily basis flying to Prudhoe Bay, with questionable numbers of Alaskans that are taking those legacy jobs right now. And I think if crafted properly, a PLA with that and legacy jobs in mind would, and with those, with Alaska higher requirements, that could be applied to those legacy jobs in the future, which would also, you know, make the difference long term for where we're going to be 20 years from now as opposed to 5 years from now. The oil companies are on record saying they can't do it without us in organized labor, and we in organized labor say we can't do it without a PLA. We don't want to slow the AGEA down. We want to speed it up and with the maximization of the best deal possible for Alaskans, and we appreciate your efforts on those lines. Thank you.
Oh, don't go away. Representative Seaton has a comment for you.
Yes, and, you know, it's kind of hard to do just on the teleconference here, especially if you if the union there doesn't have those exact words of how that was changed, and I'd appreciate it if you up there wouldn't mind getting hold of that language change that was made in Senate Judiciary. And would you email us comments on that so we can get a better analysis of that issue?
Yes, Representative, I'd be happy to. If it's okay, can I go through Representatives Guttenberg and Kawasaki to make sure they get it right into your hands?
I think that would be excellent. Please do it that way.
We'll have it to you Monday.
By the way, they asked me to tell you that congratulations on the good weather in Fairbanks. It's 90 here, and our daylight is 25 hours.
God bless our politicians.
That's a great reply. Next, I'm going to go to Lisa Pegger. Lisa, are you there? I don't hear from Lisa. Lisa, can you hear me? Lisa was actually the last one to testify.
Actually, they just turned the button on for me.
Okay, Lisa, go ahead. Give us your affiliation, please.
Okay, my name is Lisa Pegger, and I guess I'll make up an affiliation. How about the Common Sense Activist Party? Party of one so far, but I hope to get more people involved. I'm a 50-year resident of Alaska, second-generation Alaskan. I own two businesses and just a political observer, and I did not be testifying today until somebody mentioned it to me, and so I just wrote these notes on the fly, so they're not cohesive, so I'll just get into them. Just some thoughts about AGEA. First of all, I support Palin's AGEA bill, and I just want to keep you guys thinking about some things like beware the consolidation of power into the hands of one or two people. You know how the producers always want to push you to take the power from the courts to a mediator. Once again, consolidating power to a couple of individuals or one individual, and it's a lot easier to buy one individual's attention. Another thing that I'd like to talk about is competition. We need new producers to be able to come online cheaply all the time. Like Canada has 3,000 oil and gas producers, and basically in the United States we have three producers producing and distributing all of our oil and gas across the country. And, you know, what happens there is... like, for instance, Walmart. You don't see Walmart developing a store and then developing another store across the street from their first store. That would shoot themselves in the foot. And so you've got a problem with the producers not wanting to compete against themselves and all the cheap gas that they import from Qatar and Indonesia, Australia, wherever they have projects going. And so the producers are like the least likely group to want to create the gas line quickly, and this country was the reason we are the richest country in the world is, you know, first of all, God has blessed us with lots of natural resources, and mostly in the past we've acknowledged God, and God has given us the moral inspiration to let the free marketplace work as it should, because there are moral players. And so when you have competition, that is what breeds efficiency. So it's competition, competition, competition is what I want you to remember, and we need the efficiency. You know, it's kind of like Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve raising the cost of money 16 times in 2 years, and then, you know, of course, the subprime housing market crashed, and because many are no longer able to afford it anymore. But then he said we need to raise interest rates again because inflation is still happening. Well, it's the energy costs, stupid. You know, it's kind of like when Bush first lost to, the senior Bush lost to Clinton. Everybody said it's the economy, stupid, because he raised the taxes after all. Well, in this case, it's the energy costs, stupid. And I'm talking about to Bernanke, of course, now. You know, the energy cost in this country makes everything escalate, including the cost of labor and everything, cost of housing and all that. So the energy costs are so important. And since there's trillions of actual dollars worth of gas we're talking about, not trillions of cubic feet, trillions and trillions of dollars is what we're talking about. You know, all the problems that the producers or anybody else wants to bring up of the tariff problems and the roll-in problems, all these can be worked out. You know how it is. With enough money, you can take care of anything. And, you know, when they talk about financial certainty, you know, come on, give me a break. We're talking trillions of dollars. And, you know, so another point is you know, perhaps as a thought, maybe the 50 or a $500 million inducement could be an option for the state negotiators, not a given. So give it to them as a tool that is an option, you know, the $500 million. And then, let's see, and while I have you here, I'd just like to also point out that the state government is spending $30,000 per each individual Alaska worker per year, and most of that cost is labor, and it's you know, time to maybe freeze the 3% CPI, inflation-proofing the consumer price index, freeze any wage hikes, at least till the gas gets going or something. You know, politicians have dug this hole for Alaskans, you know. And instead of, you know, raiding our permanent fund dividend, instead of bringing in an income tax, and instead of forcing sales tax down our throat, like in Fairbanks here, we voted it down 6 times, and that's part of the reason that we can deal with living in this cold weather is because, you know, we have some good things going, the permanent fund dividend, no sales tax, no income tax, you know, and it's like, you know, the CPI is kind of a phony, dummy thing because, you know, most of these technological or government workers make a high rate of income. They're not so stupid that they don't buy a house. They buy a house, lock in their major inflationary cost, and then they shop at Walmart like the rest of us, and they do very well, you know. So you don't really need to go back and give the educators and government workers 3% more at every turn. But anyway, that's a locally negotiated contract issue a lot. Anyway, I support AGEA, and thank you for your time.
And thank you much for your testimony. There actually is a couple more people, both from Dillingham. So Dave McClure and Andy Anderson, are you together in Dillingham?
Yes, thank you. My name is Dave McClure. I serve as Executive Director of the Bristol Bay Housing Authority and also as Chairman of the Board of the Southwest Alaska Vocational Education Center, which is located at the U.S. Air Force Base in King Salmon. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I support the committee substitute of House Bill 177, specifically subsection 17 of section 43.90.130, which includes the project labor agreement in the application process. This PLA is vital to ensuring residents of our region and our state are hired for the workforce to be employed during construction and operation of the pipeline. During the construction of our Voc Ed Center, we created a partnership and project labor agreement with the trade unions of the state in coordination with Alaska Works Partnership, which was highly beneficial to the residents of the region. The facility was completed with at least 85% local labor, both journeymen and apprentices. Including that project and in subsequent years, we have had over 120 local folks enrolled in a general building maintenance repair and apprenticeship programs, with 10% of those folks gaining journeyman status. I also support section 43.90.470 concerning job training programs. I ask that this section include reference to training centers, including those in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the rural regional training centers, such as the SAVEC, Southwest Alaska Voc Tech Center, the People's Learning Center in Bethel, the centers in Kotzebue and St. Mary's. In conclusion, the project labor agreement and use of the training centers in the state of Alaska are critical and crucial for maximizing the use of Alaska workers in this important project. Thank you.
And thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Mr. Anderson, are you there too?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, our co-chairs, Gatto and Johnson, and members of the Resource Committee. and especially our representative, Mr. Edgemont, for allowing us the opportunity to provide input with reference to CSHB 177. My name is Andy Anderson. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, and I serve as Deputy Director of the Bristol Bay Housing Authority. My statement is short and addresses the labor provision and is in support of an equitable project labor agreement. My responsibilities for the last 14 years include the construction of affordable housing and associated infrastructure in the Bristol Bay region. As such, it is my responsibility to ensure that federal, state, and local funds allocated to low or more moderate income housing are shepherded towards providing the maximum quantity of safe, decent, and affordable housing for every dollar spent while maximizing our local labor sources. At the time I started this job, skilled building trades almost did not exist in the 32 communities BBHA serves. This paucity of local building skills forced contractors to import a majority of their labor. The creation of the Southwest Alaska Vocational Educational Center, or SAVEC, we call it, through the leadership of a dedicated core of local leaders with the financial support of federal, state, and local agencies, and with a major part being played by the Alaska Works Partnership Incorporated, has slowly but effectively reversed that situation. Mr. McClure has provided numbers of SAVEC training graduates that have allowed affordable home construction labor in the region to be 95% locally sourced. Institutions such as SAVEC, with the training and financial input of Alaska unions, will be needed to ensure that Alaskan residents are prepared to construct and operate the gas pipeline. I emphasize that it was the cooperation, training, and financial support of the union trade organizations and advocates, and their steadfast support to provide the training and entry-level opportunities for village residents that has made this, by any measure, a successful effort. The pipeline and other future major public and private constructions will be successful with the labor, leadership, organization, and demonstrated capabilities of the local unions and their organizations, ensuring maximum participation of Alaska residents. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Anderson. I have no more names before me on the printed sheets. Is there anyone else that is listening that wishes to testify? Okay, and is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to recess this meeting until 3 o'clock, where we will continue then with a presentation by the pipeline companies who have some questions for us. So with that, we are recessed until 3 o'clock. We had not closed public testimony. There is one more person who got online. Kevin McCarthy, are you there? Kevin McCarthy is not there. He was from Gakona. If he comes online again, we will go ahead and bring him back on, because public testimony will remain open, especially if we have the time. I'm expecting we'll be done by before 5, so we can enjoy that. What was it I said, 110 degrees, 90 degrees, something, some number.
You didn't make it ever better, more telling.
But it is cooling off.
God bless us, Paul.
Okay, so now we are going to have a what we'll call a roundtable discussion. The producers, mainly the companies that have drilled for the gas, had some questions they wanted to entertain with us, and we've agreed to listen to them. And maybe I shouldn't have used the word entertain, but we do want to listen to what they had some concerns over, some testimony that was done by one of the presenters. And if they indeed have some question about the accuracy of the testimony, I think it's fair and reasonable that we give them an opportunity to at least bring that question up. So with that, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourselves and your affiliation, and then go ahead and proceed.
Chairman Gatto, members of the House Resources Committee, we appreciate the opportunity that we have to address you, as you said, regarding points that have been made over the last few days, and we recognize that you do have a very busy schedule, so our comments will be brief. My name is Dave Van Tile, and I'm with BP. And with me here,
I'm Wendy King, and I'm the manager for ANS Gas Development for ConocoPhillips.
And I believe Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil is joining us by telephone.
Yes, I am on the line.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bill.
Okay. And while I represent BP, these points that I'm going to be providing in testimony have been jointly prepared by with ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil.
I'm going to ask Bill. Bill, do you represent? You have an affiliation? Is that why you're online?
Yes, I'm commercial manager for the Alaska Gas Development Group for ExxonMobil.
Okay, I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Okay. The first and most important point I want to leave with you is that we fundamentally disagree with the characterization of the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project economics as recently presented by Anthony Scott. We have concerns over many different statements made by Mr. Scott, but in the interest of time, I'm going to limit comments to addressing three key concerns. The first one is the underlying economic methodology, and specifically the idea that you can uncouple the upstream from the midstream. That's one point we want to touch on. The second point is just to understand the nature of these firm transportation commitments. And the third point is the importance of long-term cash flow in investment decision making. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to state our concerns. And I'd suggest that I go through my talking points here. It'll take about 10 or maybe 15 minutes, and then we're certainly available to spend as much time as the committee wants to answer your questions. I'm confident that, especially with Ms. King here, you won't be shy about asking questions.
Ms. King, you have experience before this committee? Or are you a member?
Okay, the first point that we wanted to emphasize is around project economics. We're very concerned that the economic analysis presented by Mr. Scott to this committee is very misleading. Without the commitment of capital to the pipeline or the huge financial obligation required for firm transportation for the midstream facilities, there's no way to realize value from the sale of gas. Thus, any analysis of the project that excludes midstream capital and firm transportation is incomplete. In reality, major gas pipeline projects are built on the back of long-term firm transportation commitments. For example, two recent gas pipeline projects in North America are Alliance and Rockies Express. Alliance required 15-year shipping commitments. Rockies Express required 10-year shipping commitments. And both of those projects are significantly smaller than the project that we're talking about here, the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project. Now, because these firm transportation commitments are just that, they're legally binding commitments, they need to be accounted for when evaluating project economics. And these commitments were ignored in Mr. Scott's analysis of the economics. And he actually mentioned that when he talked about looking at the midstream alone, that FT was the difference, and he's right in that. That analysis suggests, though, that the upstream project can be developed without a commitment to the midstream. Because that method ignores the FT obligation, the resulting assertion that our upstream economics are so robust is, frankly, it's patently incorrect. In fact, the upstream pays for the midstream. It does this through firm transportation commitments, and those commitments can't be ignored. In order to evaluate the economics of any project, you must account for the commitments that are necessary to enable the project to move forward. We must evaluate project economics on the complete project, that is, on an integrated basis, top to bottom, to properly account for total project risk and determine whether the project's economic. Any decision to invest will be based on integrated project economics, the whole. To analyze a project correctly, one needs to look at both the costs and the benefits together. That is, we need to evaluate the benefits of the reserves along with the cost of the commitments required to produce those reserves. And in fact, that's the way we do our project analysis. So to conclude this discussion on the economics, I wanted to touch on the issue of reserve booking. We've heard some discussion of reserve booking in this committee and others. We agree with the administration that being able to add reserves to our books is indeed a benefit. I mean, that's the lifeblood of our business. But we don't book reserves at any cost. They need to be economically recoverable. And we don't book the value of our reserves. We've heard that statement. We don't book the value of the reserves. Any value that's attributed to those reserves will be determined by the cost of the commitments and the investment required to get those reserves to market. And hopefully, we can get the gas to market cheaper than the market price of the gas itself. And remember that for gas, the transportation cost is a very significant portion of the value of the gas itself. And that makes gas projects with a large transportation component inherently risky. When we add reserves to our books, which we hope to be able to do for Alaska's gas resource, Wall Street will notice. But they will also notice when we inform them of the firm transportation commitments required to underpin the project and the cost of the project required to develop those reserves. So to summarize our concern with the characterization of the economics, we disagree with Mr. Scott's analysis that with a third-party pipeline, the upstream business can be analyzed separately from the midstream investment. That analysis ignores the commitments required to develop the upstream. And therefore, we believe that analysis is fundamentally flawed.
I'm going to interrupt you. Representative Fairclaw has a question.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Dave, you said that the two pipelines that were being built and you said they weren't comparable because they were much smaller, but the Rockies project is over 800 miles. So could you talk to me about why it's not comparable in some way? Is it not comparable because of the reserves that it's moving, or could you expand on that?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, certainly those two projects are just about an order of magnitude smaller in terms of cost. Rockies Express is in the neighborhood of $4 billion. And this project, we've heard numbers. The 2001 study was $20 billion. Of course, costs have escalated. Steel prices doubled since then. We've heard estimates or speculation that the cost may be $30 billion today. In any event, it's a whole another league than the Rockies Express project. Similarly, Alliance is about a $3.7 billion investment, I believe. And it moves 1.6 billion cubic feet a day compared to this project, which is 4.5, and again, the much higher capital cost. That's why we're saying they're not directly comparable.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just be asking questions in the future. To run 800 miles for the Rockies project and 800 miles in the state of Alaska, why those costs are so much different? I know transportation will be one of those, as well as the time when it goes into the ground or when we actually start construction, for the cost of materials will escalate. But $4 billion versus $30 billion is quite a difference from pretty comparable mileage.
Can you tell us the diameter of that pipe?
I don't know.
And Representative Fairclough, through the chair, if I may, the distance that the apples-to-apples comparison on difference, the scope of the project that we evaluated back in 2001-2002 that was the original $20 billion estimate was 3,600 miles. Now, we don't know for sure. We know we have to build 2,100 miles of pipe to get gas into Alberta because no transportation system exists today to get gas that far. We don't know whether or not we'll have to build new pipe from Alberta south. We assumed for comparison purposes that we would. And so that would be another 1,500 miles to get gas from Alberta into the upper Midwest market. So it was 3,600 miles for this project.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I appreciate that, and that's worst case scenario, which is what you should build for in having to put all new pipe down in your projection.
I am going to ask you, though, the $30 billion estimate is a Chicago estimate, not an Alberta estimate. Is that correct?
Representative Gatto, yes, the $30 billion assumes new pipe built all the way to Chicago. But in any event, even if new pipe isn't built out of Alberta, there will need to be firm transportation commitments made to move pipe or move gas out of Alberta, even on existing pipe.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. The second point that we want to emphasize is to ensure that we have a common understanding of the nature of these firm transportation commitments that we've just talked about. Firm Transportation Commitments, shorthand FT, as we've said, is a binding commitment. It's made by a shipper to a pipeline company in an open season to secure capacity on the pipeline for a specified duration and for a specified cost. And there's a few important facts to be clear on about FT. First, it's a binding legal obligation, and it becomes binding once the necessary conditions are met, including the pipeline coming into operation. Mr. Scott has claimed that the producers say that FT is, quote, exactly like debt.
And just for the record, Mr. Scott is the one that gave the presentation to this committee.
Correct, Chairman Gatto. I'm not aware of us having said that in our testimony. Now, long-term commercial commitments like FT are often characterized as debt-like, and they have to be reported to the SEC because of that. The core issue is whether the FT commitments require the producers to absorb the substantial majority of the risk associated with the project. Now, FT is a financial obligation, and it's certain that the lenders would have recourse to the financial security provided by the producer's FT should the pipeline company fail to meet its obligations. Therefore, FT can't be ignored if a project is to be evaluated properly.
I'm going to interrupt you. You said the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, wants to know what the debt would be. Is that correct?
Chairman Gatto, the SEC requires us to also report these long-term commercial commitments well.
Do they also ask you to report the assets?
Chairman Gatto, our annual report includes a whole host of information that includes assets, but it also includes not only debt, but these debt-like obligations, which are long-term commercial commitments.
Can you report gas in the ground as an asset?
Chairman Gatto, we can report gas in the ground once it reaches a status called proved or proven. And the vast majority of the gas in Alaska is not proven. The only portion of the gas that's proven is the portion that's used for field fuel, which is a small fraction of the known resource. It would become proven once we have a demonstrated method to actually move the gas to market, and we don't have that today.
So all of that Prudhoe Bay reserves that we know are there because those molecules have made umpteen hundred round trips to push the oil out are considered unproven.
They're a non-proven resource.
Thank you.
No waiting.
Excuse me. Representative Fairclough.
On that point, is the proven a financial term with accountants, or is it an account term within the industry?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, a proven reserve. It's often kicked around in sort of discussion, and it's perhaps. It is a term of art that's used by the SEC to establish a certain quality of resource that's reached a certainty of being developable. So there is a specific definition to reach proven. You have to cross certain hurdles.
Is it a recognized accounting term?
Yes.
That is used when you transfer it onto your books?
Yes.
In your book?
Yes.
Thank you.
And Representative Wilson?
What do they call it before it's proven?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it's called non-proven.
Oh.
That simple.
So, but then, if they say non-proven, they mean you know it's there, but it hasn't gone through those steps to make it proven.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the term that I have heard used is probable reserves, and then when they move into a category, and then there's also another term I've heard used, possible. The definitions on those are not as clearly established. It's when it moves into the proven category, and there's distinctions within the proven category itself. But the proven category itself is a defined term.
On that point,
Representative Guttenberg.
Well, there are times when it's advantageous to you to not finish the process to go from unprovable to provable, and you would simply say, let's just wait here. It would change the dynamics of the economics some way? Or would you naturally go from unproven or probable to proven as just a process?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, our primary motivation is to develop resources. And so the commercial motivation we have is to get resources develop through that value chain from known possible to probable to and then on into developed. So the motivation is actually to continue to advance those.
Just part of that line of reasoning, or that one of the things that brings up a question for me, is the amount of gas that's provable up there versus that's not provable, that might be probable or otherwise, or speculative it's there. We understand there needs to be a lot more gas than what is currently proven or being able to pull off Prudhoe. So you might know there's more gas up there and not want it proven. But as soon as it becomes an economically viable, you just finish that process and it becomes a proven reserve, and there you're going forward with it. Not a statement more than a question. No.
Thank you.
I see some shaking heads.
Representative Roses?
Thank you. I just wanted to try to use some different terms, just things that I'm familiar with, having been in the retail business. When it's in the ground, you've drilled for it. You have a pretty good idea it's there. You've discovered it. You know it's there. You may even be using it to inject back into the ground to get more oil out. So you know you have a certain amount of product. But until there's a way to deliver that to market, it doesn't become proven until there's a way to deliver it to market. So would the synonymous definition be unmarketable and marketable? Would that sort of be the same thing? If it's there and you can't get it to market, it doesn't do you any good. But the minute that there's a pipeline, you now have an opportunity to get it to market, it now becomes proven or a marketable commodity. Is that correct?
Representative Roses, through the chair, I think that's a pretty apt description. There's an aspect of commercial viability of the resource that's considered in advancing a resource from possible to probable to proven.
Right. And if I may follow up, I want to go a little bit farther on, because we keep kicking around these terms of whether it's on the books or whether it's not on the books, whether it's part of the assets or whether it's not part of the assets, and whether or not it's a debt, and whether, you know, can you borrow money against it? What's the value of it? And I guess for me, once you've made a commitment, regardless of what the price is, once you've made a commitment, yes, we're going to deliver to a pipe X amount of product, and now you're in a position where if you don't deliver the product, you're going to pay for the same amount whether you deliver it or not. So at that point in time, in my mind, it's a risk. And the risk is that you can't deliver the volume you said you could. And the way I try to keep this categorized in my head is it now becomes a debt the first day you can't deliver the amount you said you could, because now you have to pay for something you haven't put in a pipe. And so, you know, help me along this thinking process, because that's the way I try to keep it sorted out in my logical, sequential way of doing things. The minute you commit, it's a risk. Part of the risk that you have out there when you're going to borrow money is they will balance the probability of profit, the profitability, against the risk potential. And then once you start producing and you're able to produce the volume that you said, that risk starts to diminish until some point in time when you can no longer deliver. Then it becomes not a risk anymore, but an actual debt. Is that a reasonable summary of what I think I've heard you say?
Representative Roses, through the chair, I think that's a reasonable summary. The one thing that's certain about a firm transportation commitment is that the entity making that commitment will ultimately make good on that obligation to the pipeline company to which the commitment is made. That is absolutely certain, and that's why it's a legally binding obligation and can't be ignored. Hopefully, in association with making that commitment for that period, you're also able to deliver gas, but that's not a known. What's known is that firm transportation commitment is a legally binding obligation.
Thank you. May I follow up?
Follow up.
Then I want to go back to one of your earlier statements that you made today, and that's the fact that where you were saying that the economics had been misrepresented, and I'm trying to summarize what I thought I heard you say. You've got the risk pool out here. You've made a commitment to X amount of volume. And what I thought I heard you say was you cannot ignore, as a part of that volume and your commitment to inject gas into a pipeline to be delivered. You can't take the value of that without calculating what the costs were, because if you don't know what the costs were, you don't know what the, how much, for lack of a better term, what's the borrowability? How much money can I get investors to commit to on this volume of gas unless they know what all the costs are from the beginning to the end?
Representative Rose is through the chair. That's correct. The gas only flows down the pipeline if there was a commitment made up front to the builder of the pipeline for the transportation capacity for that period of time. So that commitment had to be made first to allow the gas to flow. And as you pointed out, that commitment is a real obligation. So the two have to be evaluated in concert. You can't just look at one side of the equation and ignore the other.
Representative Wilson.
Dave, and maybe for both of your companies, how have you ever had the time when has it ever happened that you didn't have the amount of gas that you? How often does that happen?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, how often does that happen? I mean, there's always risks on deliverability, on your ability to actually move gas to pipe to the pipe on a day-to-day basis. I know it has happened for BP. I could get statistics for you, I suppose, but I don't off the top of my head. I can't really give a sense for.
I mean, like it's happened three times or something. You know,
I
don't expect you to give me all that data, but I just want to know if it happens, and if it does, is it very frequent, or is it, I mean, usually, I would imagine you sure wouldn't want that to happen.
No, absolutely not.
I think Ms. King has a comment to make.
Yeah, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I've offered an observation from my personal professional experience in a couple of other hearings. I had worked previously for Conoco in the United Kingdom on the Southern Gas Basin on producing known assets, had a particularly cold winter. One winter in the UK, we're pulling particularly hard on the fields that particular winter, and we had an unexpected event. And even in known producing fields, we were not able to deliver gas from those fields for an extended period of time due to, it was a reservoir related issue, so something that was going on in the ground that translated to a surface. So that's one particular instance. I do not have any statistics collectively on deliveries and our ability to deliver, but that's just one personal example that I've had.
I want to explore this probable, possible, and proven. I'm sorry. In every one of those, there's a number that's associated with it. P90 for proven. You're sitting on the gas. You've pumped it for 20 years. You know it's there. You're allowed to say that's 90% proven. If it's possible, you can say it's 90% possible, 90% any number, but never 100%, which would account for your experiences that you just described. So if indeed Prudhoe Bay is, and I'm assuming it's 90% proven, not 100, but I'll give you the 90, then that doesn't sound like a risk.
Chairman Gatto, just to be clear on terminology, proven, again, is a, the way I use it, the way I'm familiar with it, it's a term of art in SDC reserve booking methodology. And the resource that we know about at Prudhoe Bay, and we've pumped many of the molecules two and three times around, it's not a proven resource. It's known. We know it's there, but it's not proven. Because proven requires these certain steps of commerciality. To be able to call that resource proven. So it's known, but it's not proven.
And the quantity is known. And the moment that it is available to be shoved into a pipe, it goes from known to proven?
Chairman Gatto, typically as a project matures, then it would move through the reserve categorization. And so when you get to a point where you have actually committed funds to develop the project, then the SEC or our auditors, and each company would have different reserve booking standards and whatnot, and it's subject to review by auditors and whatnot. But as soon as you commit funds to develop that project, then they say, okay, that's evidence that there's a commitment to the project and sufficient commercial viability because you're willing to put your investment into the project. Now we'll allow you to move that into the proven category. And there's actually subcategories within proven. To be proved undeveloped up until it actually gets put into production. And until it's matured to that point, it will not be a proven resource. I don't know if Wendy or Bill want to add to that.
Let me just take the example of you are not the pipeline builder. Someone else is. And you're sitting there on the sidelines. You're not committing any money to build a pipeline. Someone else is. And as they progress and build the pipeline, you are still on the sidelines waiting for the opportunity to bid for your reserves. At that point, do you take a look at all the gas you have proven possible, any other category we can come up with, and then take a look and decide that today I'm making my FT? Is there something that happens at the moment you make your FT in a pipeline you do not own? You've taken on a responsibility to pay for the shipment of whatever FT you have, but you've also gained the asset, the bookable reserve. Help me out here. Is this not true?
Well, Chairman Gatto, we're actually starting into a realm that each company will have its own potentially its own thresholds and standards of reserve booking, and I don't know if I can tell you definitively in that scenario when a bookable reserve would occur. And I don't know if, Wendy, if you want to.
Chairman Gatto, I would just request that the questions about how we might view things with respect to individually making decisions around an open season, we would need to handle that in an individual forum.
I'm not sure what that means. Help me out again. Does that mean that is proprietary information?
Well, Chairman Gatto, an open season is a competitive process.
Huh?
And we need to act. We're competitors. We need to act independently and be able to compete.
And there's another competitor on the phone. I understand.
Yes, I would like to share a bit.
Okay, go ahead.
Chairman Gatto, you know, you've been questioning us about you know, the progression of the booking of reserves, and I guess in general, what I would say is that, you know, you would go through stages as the project gets closer and closer to startup. You know, an individual company may get more and more confident, and you know, one strategy could be to book a portion of the proved reserves as you make key milestones along the way. You know, perhaps a portion when you make commitments in the open season, perhaps a portion when the pipeline company gets their permits, perhaps another portion when the pipeline company sanctions or funds the project, perhaps that, another portion whenever the project actually starts up. So, you know, I haven't viewed the booking of the proved reserves in this project as being a singular event. It, depending on the way your company chooses to handle it, it could be a series of events.
And my understanding was it's sort of like a funnel, and the white part of the funnel says you have no certificate, you have 100% uncertainty, and the narrow part of the funnel says your uncertainty is now down to 5%. And so there's some place between that 100 and that 5 where you have a significant amount of certainty, and therefore you're willing to book certain amounts. Is that a fair appraisal?
Chairman Gatto, that word picture of a funnel, I think, is appropriate. As you narrow uncertainty, then your confidence to represent this gas resource to the investment community as proved increases.
Representative Fairclough has a question.
I wanted to follow up on Representative Rose's when you were talking about cost fluctuations and your FT commitments. You talked about in the reservoir instance in the United Kingdom. Did your company have a clause within the contract for acts of God or acts of war or some way that you had outs not to have to pay to the shippers because you had a lack of ability to move gas?
Representative Faircloth, through the chair, the particular instances of that is actually confidential with that particular agreement there, but I would offer that force majeure clauses are typical clauses in some arrangements. But the nature of making a firm shipping commitment by which you are not necessarily committing the gas, but where you are committing to pay every day, whether you deliver that gas or not, there's a component of the charge that's called a demand charge. And if you don't deliver gas that day, you are still subject to a demand charge. And I would anticipate that a pipeline entity, if you negotiated firm shipping commitments, there would be a discussion with respect to how to handle a force majeure event.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, what I'm looking for is, wouldn't you negotiate some kind of flexibility in the contract to reduce that risk on the demand clause if something unforeseen happened? And so if the pipeline's not built, you went out and you got a shipping commitment, firm transportation, and the pipeline didn't materialize, you wouldn't be forced to move gas.
Representative Faircloth, through the chair. Typically, what happens on a pipeline, gas pipeline project, is up until the pipeline is put into service, there's something called a completion guarantee that governs. And so the entity that's building the pipeline has a guarantee to its lenders that the project will be completed. And up until that point, the holders of the firm transportation commitment, those commitments are not yet binding. That's when I said they become binding when certain obligations are met, and one of them is the project being placed in service. Typically, it's always a dangerous word, but typically, once a project is placed in service, if the pipeline's ready to go and in operation and something happens on the upstream end where something's wrong with my wells or whatnot and I'm unable to deliver gas to the project, that doesn't excuse me of my obligation. If, however, on the pipeline end, there's some reason that they're unable to receive gas, then that typically would relieve me of that obligation up until the time the pipeline is again able to receive gas. But those, as you point out, they're the subject of a negotiation between the pipeline company and the shipper, just exactly the nature of those sorts of clauses.
Representative Roses?
I have a different question, but kind of along the similar discussion. I guess for me, when we're talking about risk and assets and liabilities and debt and so on, if you go out and you do your seismic studies and you think, okay, we have potentially X amount of gas, and then you go out and you drill some exploratory wells and you say, yep, well, not only do we think there's gas, we think there might be this much. And then you actually drill the wells, you got oil, you're reinjecting, you know how much is there within a reasonable amount that's marketable. Then somebody builds a pipeline and then you commit to a certain amount, that's the FT. At what point in that process of all of those different scenarios, from reserves to probables to known reserves and then proven reserves and then actually an FT commitment, at what point in time does that commodity become the most valuable for getting investors to participate in a project? Where does it become the biggest asset to any company?
That's a good question.
Do you want to take an at ease or?
At what point does it become the most valuable? Representative Roses, through the chair, I would think that that commodity, that gas, is the most valuable once it's able to be placed into a market, that provided the market wants to accept that commodity, if there's a market for the commodity. So it's once the investment's been delivered, provided the investment's delivered in a manner that you can get that commodity to market at a price below the, or at a cost below the price of the commodity. I don't know. Wendy and Bill probably have a much better answer.
Representative Roses, through the chair, I wanted to go back to my testimony from Monday where I tried to illustrate that gated decision-making process, and that's why I think you saw a bit of a pause here as I was trying to think through each of those gates. Clearly a critical milestone would be the open season. Has there been a firm shipping commitment been made? You will continue to do more engineering work. You'll continue to do more environmental permitting work in parallel while you're going through your FERC certification process. You will continually be getting updated cost estimates. You'll be getting more information about the market. And so partly it's a little bit of an unknowable question because you don't know what might happen in the market. That's exactly the critical uncertainties that at least I was trying to illustrate in my testimony on Monday, was that there is going to be uncertainties, and we are going to do all we can in developing a project to try to mitigate those risks and uncertainties as it advances. But you don't know what's going to happen, for example, to the price of steel or the cost of labor. And so you might see fluctuation in the price of natural gas.
If I'm not mistaken, all of this conversation is what's leading us to determine what the net present value is. And Mr. Scott's presentation is a presentation that affected his number, is different from your number, and I believe that's the purpose of this hearing, or hearing. Are we moving in that direction satisfactorily? Because I know that's what your intent was.
Chairman Gatto, we're going to touch on just that, at least briefly in just a moment, on the specific discussion of net present value as a measure of the viability of a project.
Go ahead.
Could I follow up on the question that I asked? And I appreciate that, and I sort of anticipated from all the discussions that probably your answer would be when you've made that firm commitment, because you now have a marketable product and you have a commitment to a certain volume of product. But what I also thought I heard you say, and you can correct me if I misunderstood it, but that's also where you've been classifying it as your greatest risk. So it becomes your greatest asset and your greatest risk all at the same time.
Representative Rose, through the chair, I mean, it certainly is a great risk, because I would have made the firm transportation commitment to ship the commodity, but at any point in time, I don't know. I certainly hope I can get in the marketplace a sufficient price for that commodity to cover my costs, but I never know that for the duration of the firm transportation commitment I've just made. So I can see why you would make that statement.
So if it's my greatest asset and my potentially greatest risk, I'm going to try to maximize the amount that I put into it so that I'm capitalizing on my greatest potential asset. And therefore, I want to push as hard as I can to make sure that the price is as low as it is at all aspects of it. So therefore, I'm mitigating or minimizing the potential risk.
Representative Rose, through the chair, you're exactly right. There are certain things that we can try to control or at least influence to reduce those risks that we can, like the cost of the project and whatnot. There's other risks that we can't control. So if we can control the risks that we can, you increase the likelihood that you'll have a happy outcome.
Would you care one whit about the risk if you were the pipeline owner?
Representative Gatto, Chairman Gatto, I think you want to make sure that you're going to have customers for a long period of time, to have an expanding project and more customers. So I think you would want to have a project that attracts customers. A bit of the dynamic, I guess, is that if you're just a pipeline company, your source of revenue is from the rate base. It's your only source of revenue. And so you're actually motivated to increase the rate base and increase the tariff to a point to make sure you still have customers. You don't want to price yourself completely out of the market, but the motivation is to increase the rate base, which is different from someone who wants to maximize the value of the resource, which would want a lowest possible cost project.
Thank you. And because this pipeline is certainly a monopoly pipeline, then the builder of the pipeline would not have much of an interest except to make sure that it costs quite a bit if the builder is going to get a fixed rate of return, such as 15%, would that be something we would expect from a person who had no interest except to build the pipeline?
Well, Chairman Gatto, I'd answer your question maybe indirectly in saying that as a resource owner, we would certainly have the motivation to deliver a low-cost project to kind of prevent the situation that you're describing. We would want a low capital cost and a low operating cost project to ensure that the value of the resource is maximized through time.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Well, it just seemed like a little of a disconnect because we've had exactly the same problem with the producer-owned pipeline and TAPS, in that the impetus by the producer-owned pipeline has not been to keep the rates as low as possible, because the value of the royalty gas or royalty oil and the transportation costs that the state pays on its royalty gas is taken, and we have no ownership in the pipeline, so we don't get any royalty base there. So, you know, of course it's in court now. I just want to point out the disconnect between what we're saying here is that if it's a pipeline producer-owned pipeline, they are obviously trying to get the lowest possible tariff, and that hasn't been the case demonstrated, or at least the interstate portion and the intra, and it'll all be figured out in court. But that's the situation that we're working on right now.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we do want the lowest possible cost, capital cost project. Sure. I mean, FERC will adjudicate the rates associated with that project, and they'll look at the return on equity and the cost of debt and all those components. But because we want to maximize the value of the resource, we want the lowest cost project that we can possibly deliver. And then we'll subject the rates themselves to FERC to look at, to make sure that they are just and reasonable.
And
go ahead.
To follow up, you know, and I agree. I think you want the lowest cost product project. You know, that's no question. Whether that's the lowest tariff is a different discussion. But
it is.
The other thing is the portion of risk that we're talking about, and if we're talking about the risk being borne by the pipeline company for delays in getting done, because your FT doesn't kick in until even like an in-kind debt, until the pipeline goes in service. So the risk is on the pipeline owner and the people that are doing the debt service on the pipeline, because as you said, FT doesn't go into effect until the pipeline goes in service. So I'm, you know, there's a few things in there that I'm just unclear how they, you know, all ball around and affect each other, but I'm sure it's there somewhere.
Go ahead.
Do we want to? Okay. Should I continue with that?
Yeah, please.
Okay. We were talking about the nature of firm transportation commitments, and just to conclude that portion of our comments, we just wanted to remind the committee that generic statements about the treatment of long-term commercial commitments is dangerous, to make generic statements. Because commitments of the magnitude required to underpin this project are absolutely massive in both the dollar amount of the commitments and the likely duration that those commitments will take. In fact, those commitments are going to create their own weather in the financial markets just because of their size. Therefore, they have to be considered when you evaluate the economics of a project. The last point we wanted to touch on is that confidence in future cash flows is very important when we evaluate the commercial viability of any investment decision. And it's particularly true for a commitment as large as the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project. And Mr. Scott, in his testimony, suggested that cash flows beyond 10 years are effectively inconsequential in financial decision-making on a project.
Just for clarity here, he did say, I don't think he ever used the word inconsequential. I think he maybe made the point that it was significantly abbreviated, but I never heard the word inconsequential.
Representative Gott, I'll accept your correction. I think the point stands that the implication was that the focus is on the cash flows for the first 10 years, and beyond that they become less important.
I'll buy that.
And we would say that that's just not true. Cash flows further out in time do have less of an impact on the net present value. Now, that absolutely is true. But cash impact years into the future will indeed be real on any project. And many factors are evaluated to evaluate a go or no-go decision on a project. NPV is certainly one. But other measures are looked at, too, like internal rate of return, the productivity index that was talked about. But the ability of a project to generate long-term cash flow is also a very important consideration to investors. It's important to bear in mind that we expect the FT commitments that we just talked about will be in effect well beyond 10 years. So those making the long-term commitments will want to know that they're able to make good on them. And lenders will want to know that too.
Representative Guttenberg?
What do you see the duration of the FTs going into a first open season? What are the length of times that are normal? And then normal maybe versus a project like this?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the duration of FT can vary all over the map, and it depends on the project. The ones that we just referenced, Alliance Pipeline going from Alberta into the Chicago area was 15 years, and it was for a 1.6 billion cubic foot a day, $3.7 billion project, 15-year FT. Rockies Express, 10-year FT. For this project, because it's significantly bigger in just the size of the project, the cost, expected cost, and the nature, we expect the duration of the FT required to be commensurately longer. Can we say with certainty what duration that'll be? No. In general, an important trend to know, too, is the longer the term of the FT, the lower the risk on the pipeline, and therefore the lower the toll that would be charged by the pipeline. So there's actually a benefit to the shipper to be able to enter into longer FT because you get a lower toll. Of course, that's weighed against the risk of having to enter into that longer commitment. So there's a trade-off. But generally, we'd expect this to be longer.
And Representative Guttenberg, I have a Lukens Energy Report in front of me, and a few pages from the back, it has a profile. And the profile shows that from about 0 to 12 years, it's 100%. From 12 to 15, it looks like it's so close to 100 as to be 97, and then it has the falling off. But 15 years is pretty good for 100%, and that is 4.3 BCF Alaska Gas Reserve profile. So that's what we're talking, 15 years, at least.
At least.
Unless you disagree with this report.
Chairman Gatto, I'm not sure what report you're referring to, so I couldn't comment that we disagree with it.
Lukens Energy Group from Houston. You familiar with that company?
Yes.
Chairman Gatto, I'm familiar with the company.
Okay. Well, it's written by Dr. J. Lukens, and it's dated June 30th, 05. Go ahead.
Okay. Let's take just a minute to consider this, the point about the importance of future cash flows from a bit of a different perspective. When we're making a decision to purchase a home that you know you're going to live in for 30 years, will the interest rate on your mortgage still matter after 10 years? I think it will. Will the property tax assessment no longer matter after 10 years? Or will the property tax rate still matter? They certainly will matter because cash generation is an important factor in personal budgeting, just as it is to major corporation in making an investment decision. Well, getting this project right has enough challenge of its own, let alone when we have such fundamental disagreement with how the project is characterized. So thank you for the opportunity to share with you the concerns that we have. And as I mentioned at the start, we have many other concerns with Mr. Scott's testimony, but I've limited these remarks this afternoon to those three areas. That concludes the testimony that was prepared by BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil, unless Wendy or Bill have anything they'd like to add.
Bill, you've been invited to make a statement or sorts if you'd like. Do you want to?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Gatto. I just want to reinforce what Mr. Vantal has shared about our concern with this analysis, and this represents our three major concerns. I do have a follow-up with a question about the TAPS tariff dispute that we have. See Representative Seaton through the chair. I guess what makes TAPS different than the Alaska Gas Pipeline is that TAPS is complete and running. Now, we know how much it cost, and the owners of TAPS are simply trying to receive the return on their investment that was agreed. Now, it's understandable that shippers on the on TAPS would like to have a lower tariff, and that's what they're requesting. And, you know, FERC is been given the authority to settle this difference of opinion. You know, they are the ones that have the final say on tariffs. And so what we've focused on so far in talking about lowest possible cost, that's because the Alaska Gas Pipeline hasn't been built yet. So that's really the dichotomy there.
In the TAPS, I believe you're referring to the TAPS settlement methodology?
Yes, sir.
And under that methodology, the RCA would determine the tariff if the pipe were completely within the state and the product did not leave the state, as opposed to the product leaving the state. Am I correct?
Chairman Gatto, that is my understanding about the jurisdiction of the FERC versus the jurisdiction of the RCA.
Okay, and the understanding is that the oil goes to Valdez. If it's used in the state, the tax is $2. The oil goes to Valdez. If we put it on a boat and it sails away from the dock, the tariff is over $5. That was a huge discrepancy, and it certainly affected people who didn't own the pipeline but wanted to ship oil. And I believe the state is one of those people. Now, it's my understanding that hasn't been decided yet. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And the decision maker is the FERC?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think that's fair. Is there any other questions? No other questions? Committee members, okay. Want to make some comments? That would be a good time. Ms. King?
I just would add that we'll further expand on our comments if given the opportunity to testify in future committees and further elaborate on those comments. So,
fair thought. As you know, it goes from this committee to finance, and we haven't heard of any proposed amendments from producers, and my guess is they're being stacked somewhere. Representative Roses?
Thank you, and I appreciate your comments about being willing to have further discussion in other committees, but I don't sit on any other committees. So if there's substantial information that you think we ought to have that you haven't given us, or areas that you think are major conflicts on things that we've heard, I've got to make my decisions on whether I'm going to offer amendments or not offer amendments based on the facts that I've been given. So in order for me to do the best job I can do, I need the information. So if you've got substantial information that you think you may be giving to somebody else and you have it available, I don't know about the rest of the committee, but I'd certainly like to hear it.
Representative Roses, through the chair, clearly the 3 points that we brought into our testimony today are the biggest focus areas that we would like to focus on today. And from this committee has had the, whether or not you would call it the benefit, I would question that, but you've heard me comment for approximately 4.5 hours on Monday. And so many of those points, I would just reiterate those hold. And some of the critical issues around uncertainties, I wanted to add a comment with respect to, we've had a lot of conversations around reserves. One of the critical issues that we will always face is deliverability of those reserves. Gas in the ground is different than what you can produce the rate of the gas at. And that was the example I was trying to illustrate of my personal experience professionally in the United Kingdom. The gas was clearly in the ground. You just couldn't produce it at the rate you thought you could. And so when you look at the nature of a 20 to 25 year shipping commitment, which has been the range that people have contemplated with the cost estimates previously, that you're going to make assumptions not only about what the resource is, but the deliverability of that resource for a long duration and substantially with a long lead time before the project's completed. Remember that the timeline that we showed in our testimony on Monday had an eight-year and a success case between when a conclusion of an open season would occur and you'd be able to deliver full volumes from the pipeline. So that the nature of this project being so big, the lead times and the numbers are substantial. So most of those comments, Representative Rosas through the chair, have been covered either through my individual testimony and supplemented by what the three critical points we felt needed to be raised today. So thank you for the opportunity.
Continue.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't information that we haven't been privy to yet, and so I appreciate the fact that you've already covered it, and if you have, I've got the notes. So I did have one other question, if I might.
Go ahead.
Most of the public testimony we heard today was around the project labor agreements, but there was one individual that called, and I don't want to use any names, but I think you were both in the audience, and you heard them say that this entire thing is a joke, that there's not enough reserves, and by the time you pump it back in there to get the oil out of the ground, that we're wasting our time and our money, and we should cease and desist. Would you care to comment on that?
And we have to finish up by 5. So.
Representative Rosas through the chair, I'll certainly make my comments before 5. We don't share that view. We committed $125 million between the three companies to advance the project, to do the study work that we did, with demonstrating sufficient confidence that we would indeed be able to get this gas to market. We continue to be encouraged about the prospects that this project has to be able to deliver gas to market. We at BP like to talk about this 50-year future. It's only possible if we get Alaska's gas to market, and we believe it is possible. That makes a lot of other things possible, like development of heavy oil on the slope and extending the life of TAPS. So we absolutely are committed to be able to get Alaska's gas to market, and we recognize that there are some hurdles that you have to do. There's regulatory hurdles like getting offtake rates established by AOGCC. We heard Commissioner Forrester testify about that process and where we are at Prudhoe and the fact that we've established a data room and had quite a bit of work done to develop a common understanding of that reservoir and what appropriate offtake rates might be. We haven't made the specific request yet because we want to make sure that the timing's consistent with when we have the best quality data and whatnot, but Commissioner Forrester stated her confidence in that process and the ability to get where we need to get. At least that was my interpretation of her testimony. Wendy, if you wanted to.
Representative Rosas through the chair, just to point back to my testimony, ConocoPhillips has worked very hard since 2000 trying to advance the gas pipeline project, and we believe there's value, potential value in this project, and want to continue to pursue that. And so we don't believe that the project's without risk. We believe there are no guarantees when it comes to how the project economics will turn out. That was part of our key focus today. But we are continuing to work, and we want to continue to work trying to advance the pipeline project.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I think the most of your testimony here has been talking about upstream and, you know, looking at that in the aspects of this of AGEA. And one thing that I think you both testified, and maybe all three of you, including online, was that the royalty inducements and the upstream, the switching, the changing from the lease term to 90 day, I think it's 90 day switching from royalty in value to royalty in kind, and even the proposed bill where it has that switching taking, I think it's 2 years, that could be switched on a longer notice. And you'd both testified that the switching, that the ability of the state to be able to switch from royalty in value to royalty in kind was problematic for you. And we had talked about a potential of looking at a way to do royalty in value with the guarantee that you would supply to those in-state residential and commercial markets. Is that something that you are still interested in pursuing so that there wouldn't be RIK, RIV switching, or is that less meaningful to you at this point in the project?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we're interested in pursuing any means that we can find that's mutually agreeable that would mitigate that risk. The risk of RIV-RIK switching, it's incompatible with the long-term contracts that are required, the FT commitments that we talked about that might span decades, as well as the purchase and sale agreements that are on the back end of the pipe, which, depending on your marketing arrangement, could be short, could be long. Each company does it in its own way. Any way that we can find to find a mutually agreeable solution, we're certainly willing to investigate.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, with respect to the RIK, RIV switching, you're correct that is an area. In fact, the entire area of the resource inducements is an area that we would want to continue to try to find a way to work those resource inducements prior to an open season. So that is one area out of a number of areas within the resource inducements that we think we would like to continue to have a conversation with both the legislature and the administration on.
And,
go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that probably the high side of RIV of in-state use would be probably 0.3 BCF. I mean, just on residential and commercial, I definitely want to make sure that we're not talking about industrial, where somebody would say we want to have LNG plant and export and any commitment there. I mean, those are commercial arrangements that the producers and the sellers would be. But of course, our a lot of portions in AGEA are to ensure that we have gas for in-state usage. So do you see, under reasonable terms, if there's a reasonable way to work that out, do you see the elimination of RIK, RIV switching with the assurance that you would supply that in-state gas at disincentive rates? Do you see that as something that would be a way to mitigate that problem for you as not having to deal with on the initial, at initial FT, at open season on those amounts, not forever on everything, but you see that as something that would be beneficial moving in the direction you'd like to go? Or
Representative Seaton, through the chair.
Go ahead.
This is Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. I guess what I'd like to highlight in the area of trying to find an acceptable way forward, Marty Massey testified before this committee about 10 days ago, and this example highlights the need to make AGEA become objective-driven. If we understand what the state's needs are in the way AGEA lays out the way the bids need to be made and what's important, then that will free up the applicants to propose innovative ways to meet the state's needs. And then given that freedom, then it would be possible for an applicant to address the concern with RIK, RIV switching and its incompatibility with firm transportation commitments, and also try to address the state's needs for making sure gas is available and deliveries are made in-state. So I think something's workable. We just need to have AGEA crafted to allow those kind of creative ideas to get onto the table.
Okay, and thank you. So I'm hearing you saying also that from Exxon's standpoint that RAK royalty in value and royalty in kind switching is problematic for you, as well as that's what I'm hearing from BP and ConocoPhillips as potential shippers. And I just wanted to clarify that. Who is on the line?
This is Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil.
Oh. Thanks, Bill. And was I restating what you were saying correctly?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
And Bill, when gas is shipped down the pipe and we take it as in kind, then there's a space. There's like a slug of vacuum going down the line. Is that a fair way to look at it? That space that somebody must be paying for, since we off-took the gas, What happens to that empty, that available space for new gas?
Chairman Gatto, it depends on when that gas occurs. If the state is going to take gas in kind and deliver it to an in-state market, if you know that going into the open season and you bid that capacity to that delivery point, then the pipeline constructor, the people designing the pipeline, will know that, and they'll be able to design the pipe downstream of that point so that there isn't a vacuum, so there isn't an unused piece of capacity. Now, if that in-state delivery materializes and is made after the pipeline's been designed and built, then yes, there is a there could be some stranded capacity or some unused capacity downstream of that point, and that would need to be paid for. You know, the lenders who will loan the money to this project to have it built are going to need to be paid, so you know that's for the entire line, not just for pieces of the line.
So a pipeline builder would prefer a pipe to have no offtakes.
No, sir. The pipeline builder would prefer to know where the offtakes will be and what the volumes will be, so that the pipeline can be designed to match that service.
Dave?
Chairman Gatto, if I may, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act actually envisions a in-state use study to be conducted prior to the initial open season, presumably with the motivation to get a better handle on exactly that situation so that the pipeline could be designed appropriately, because you'll get a handle on what in-state requirements would be and whatnot before the open season specifically, so it could be designed appropriately and avoid the situation that you described.
Okay. I'm guessing the pipe doesn't change, though. We don't resize the pipe following an offtake. We have the same pipe for the entire length, switch it around.
Chairman Gatto, it depends on the magnitude of the offtake that we're talking about. Typically, that could be accommodated through how you design the compression system downstream. It could be that you have a smaller diameter pipe if it's a significant change in the offtake, but otherwise it could be handled through the design of the compression system.
And I believe the administration wants to write regulations where the amount of offtake, the bigger the offtake, the longer the lead time that the pipeline companies would have for switching. That's my understanding of how it would be handled. And I just felt concerned that, I don't know how much we could offtake, but Representative Seaton says up to 0.3.
No. Mr. Chairman, it generally in our last considerations of the last package, it was generally considered that allowing for future growth in use will probably 0.3 BCF for all residential and commercial in a foreseeable future kind of usage in state. Now, that doesn't include something like Nikiski LNG or Agrium or another industry, but like I said, the chief concern I think with NG is to make sure we have commercial and residential uses covered, and I think that's a Dave or Wendy'd like to comment, but I think that's probably been considered as probably one of the outer bounds of the amount of use in the near future.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, those order of magnitude of figures are consistent with some of the previous studies that have been done with respect. Like my colleague pointed out, there would be a requirement by the FERC to adopt or conduct an in-state needs study prior to an open season to help design and offer in an open season services to service in-state needs.
And I checked with the technician. We don't have anyone online, and I don't see anyone in the audience who wants to testify, so we'll close public testimony. At this point, anyone? Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had the privilege of sitting here for a couple of weeks, and listening and enjoying the dialogue and arriving here at a state of being completely confused, and I think today being partially confused about this whole subject matter. So I feel a lot like I'm on more solid grounds, but just sort of a basic question. You know, as I sat through the testimony and learned a lot more about AGEA and the various components and so forth, it just seems to me that, you know, we're at a, let's just assume that this bill goes through the process, it gets signed by the governor, and it reflects pretty closely to what the version is that we have here before us today. So we're, you know, I guess if I'm hearing correctly from the producers, it'll be unacceptable at that level. I mean, you won't be able to participate because of the fundamental differences that at least I'm hearing being expressed so forth. But so what happens if this bill goes through that process with that assumption that it's close to what it looks like today? You know, where are the three producers at that point?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, if AGEA passed in the form that's currently depicted in this version of House Bill 177, I think it's fair to say that we wouldn't be in a place that we could submit a bid, we BP. We highlighted in our testimony here and elsewhere the chief concerns that we have that would need to be addressed to put us in the place where we could, and we still hope that we can get the bill to that place because we very much want to be able to submit a bid, and we think that's, we want to be able to get the bill in a place that gives the maximum chance for a gas pipeline to be built. So that's what we're going to be focused on in the near term, getting to a place that allows us to bid and encourages the pipeline to get built. I don't, right now, I'd really not like to speculate on the alternatives that beyond that. We really want to get it to a place that it will work and allow us to bid and compete.
Representative Edgman.
Mr. Chairman, then a follow-up. Is my characterization of fundamental differences, is that an overstatement then in terms of the bill as it is today with the desires of the three producers in terms of having some kind of a legislation that would work towards your interests? I mean, is that there are some fundamental differences here on the table?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, this is Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. There are fundamental differences. As AGEA is currently drafted, it is very prescriptive on the way the state expects a proposal to be tabled. And we believe, as Mr. Massey testified earlier, that in its current form it actually limits competition. And we would recommend that a less prescriptive bill be substituted, and one that clearly lays out the objectives that the state of Alaska has, and then invites applicants to propose how they best meet those objectives, and then put together criteria for the state to then select the one that best meets their objectives.
Okay, this is Representative Gatto. I know Ms. King had suggested the term bid variables to be substituted for must-haves. That sounds completely like the previous administration's goal of saying, you know, tell us what you need, we'll give it to you. And then we'll get a contract and we'll build a line, and I hope the state will be happy, but we're not sure. We know the pipeline companies would be excited. And that is the problem, and the very issue is the must-haves are, in my estimation, very tolerable must-haves, but they do limit the competition in some ways, because Joe's Pipeline Company can't just walk in and say, I'll do it for $10 million, I want the license. You have to be able to present to the commissioners, who are backed up by a building full of attorneys and revenue people and DNR people, and won't be making their decision outside of all of the recommendations that they will receive. And on top of that is the governor, who will certainly be a tiebreaker. We all want a pipeline. We do. I'm expecting that I don't know if I'm expecting it. An independent company will probably have the most interest. What I hear from the producers is that very scary part that almost sounds like we're not going to bid, but it never makes the statement we're not going to bid. We might not be interested at this point. I can't recommend it. It could be improved. Lots of variables in the testimony that leave you in the running. But I believe you're looking for that last ounce of flesh. How do we make our company better off today than if we didn't say something, if we didn't act in some way? Somebody has to help me out from the producers that sets me in a different course, and I'm not hearing it. What I'm hearing is, you know, we'll be there because we have to. Actually, we want to. This is a dream project. This is a project like no other in the world, mostly because it is mightily expensive. But we've seen that so many pipelines, I mean, they had them all lined up with these little bars getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then he finally got to the last one that said Alaska, and the bar shot out to here. That's how important this pipeline project was. I also think the country depends on this pipeline project. I also think the president, the Congress, the state governments all want this pipeline project because it does give some measure of energy, gets rid of some energy dependency on other countries, and gives us some measure of energy sufficiency. I'm begging you, do not give up on this project and say, you know, if we don't get what we want, then we can't bid. Because I believe somebody will bid, and I want you to have every opportunity to be there among the bidders. You have some issues, I'm sure you do. I'm sure I know what you want, and I'm sure you're not telling us because you're waiting for this next committee. Because I haven't heard from the producers, here is my amendment. We're going to have amendments Monday. We're going to have amendments. Every single one is from the administration. I don't have any that are coming from you. Because you are what? Not interested? Holding them for a better moment? Timing might be important. But I wish we have them in front of us on Monday. But if you don't have them in front of us, this committee will do just fine. I think we've worked plenty hard in trying to get the best possible background that we know of to be able to address whether or not we pass out this bill, which leads to the contract. All of us are waiting for that. All of us want it. And I certainly want to thank all my colleagues here for showing up at every time I ask them to and having a full house as well as some guests, because they're all interested in representing their different communities and getting that licensee who can give us the best net present value, and number two, the highest likelihood of success. That's all we're after. And I think you can do it, and you can do it, and Exxon can do it. I hope you're willing. But absent that, we'll get our amendments, and I'm not sure what's just being brought in right now.
Probably the administration amendment.
Okay, so those are the amendments. I wanted to pass them out to the members that we'll be seeing on Monday. So if you're really bored during the skits tonight, you can kind of thumb through your amendments. With that, I want to mention that we have no meeting tomorrow. Hope you enjoy the day as best you can. We'll see you back here on Monday, and this meeting is adjourned.